You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Takes on the World News.
This is Jeff Blankford with the June 27th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. The extraordinary national outcry in response to the Trump administration's unbridled cruelty and its imprisoning of men and women seeking asylum at the Mexican border while kidnapping their children has understandably dominated the news cycles, pushing almost every other unrelated story to the margins. One that probably would have ended there anyway, given the sensitivity of the subject, appeared in the New Yorker's June 18th issue. Written by Adam Entis, one of the magazine's staff writers, it was entitled, How Trump and Three Other U.S. Presidents Protected Israel's Worst-Kept Secret, Its Nuclear Arsenal, end quote. In his article, Entis described how four sitting U.S. presidents, beginning with Bill Clinton, had been obliged by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to sign secret letters agreeing never to publicly discuss Israel's undeclared nuclear arsenal. As the Obama administration earlier experienced, Trump's aides fell blindsided when an Israeli delegation came to Washington, led by its ambassador, the U.S.-born Ron Dermer, and demanded that Trump sign the same letter. Trump's aides were confused, wrote Entis, and initially said they needed more time. U.S. officials said that the Israelis wanted to limit who could take part in discussions of the letter, citing the need for secrecy. The Americans pushed back. Afterward, wrote Entis in the New Yorker, senior White House officials huddled together and complained to each other that Dermer had acted as though he owned the White House, end quote. While the mainstream media has a history of running away from any story that might expose the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons, to listeners of Takes on the World, their existence has been no secret. One of my frequent guests, Grant Smith, has long been trying to call attention to the White House's silence on the subject and its implications, namely the violating of U.S. law that prohibits U.S. aid to any country caught involved in the production of nuclear weapons that does not sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which unambiguously describes Israel. On Monday, Smith, the director of IRMIP, the Washington-based Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy, wrote a follow-up to the New Yorker article entitled, quote, Four presidents conspired to give $100 billion to Israel, secret White House letters buttress ongoing U.S. Arms Export Control Act violations, end quote. An aspect of the subject that was missing from the New Yorker article. At approximately 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking with Grant Smith about his article, as well as that of Adam Entis in The New Yorker. We'll be examining the significance of Israel's protected nuclear weapons program, while the Trump administration is both trying to strike a deal with North Korea to destroy its existing nuclear weapons, and at the same time appearing to prepare for an attack on Iran, which has none. Iran, of course, has frozen its nuclear enrichment program under the deal signed with the U.S. and its fellow members of the U.N. Security Council, plus Germany, that Trump, stifling Washington's co-signers, has effectively abrogated. So stay tuned for that. On the subject of Israel's nuclear weapons, I had a personal experience 36 years ago that I think is useful to share with you. In the summer of 1982, following Israel's unprovoked invasion of Lebanon, an action that troubled many in the American Jewish community, Ehud Olmert, then the secretary to Prime Minister Menachem Begin, and who would later become a prime minister himself, came to San Francisco to debate Mordechai Baron of Peace Now over the legitimacy of the war at one of the city's largest synagogues. After the event, in which the almost overflow audience was unusually quiet, my sister and I joined a small group of attendees that was engaged with Olmert near the synagogue's entrance. My sister took the opportunity to ask him about Israel's nuclear weapons. Without hesitating a moment, Olmert replied emphatically, "We have missiles trained on Moscow, but it doesn't mean we're going to use them." And then he repeated the very same sentence with the same emphasis. It was a clear acknowledgment that Israel had nuclear weapons trained on Russia and the means to deliver them as far back as 1982. Again, Israel and its nuclear weapons and Washington's violation of the U.S. Arms Export Control Act in covering up for them will be up for discussion with Grant Smith at 20 minutes past the hour. For reasons I will leave you to speculate, reporting by the U.S. media about Washington and Israel's plans for Iran have been something less than complete. Back in late December, I reported on Takes on the World and repeated a couple of times since that an Israeli television station and the English-language Times of Israel had carried a story confirmed by Washington that the intelligence agencies of the two countries had met in our nation's capital and on December 12th had signed an unprecedented secret multi-task intelligence agreement targeting Iran and its activities all over the region, including Syria and Lebanon. Since the story had broken in the Israeli press, it was no longer a secret, but the U.S. media decided to treat it as if it was, and thus you, along with the rest of our population, have seen or heard not a single word of this agreement, aside from a brief citation of the Times of Israel article in the Business Insider on December 28th, the day the original article was published. Another story you haven't heard or read about was Dateline Tel Aviv and published on the Saudi-backed Ashaq al-Azwat news site in Beirut. It was headlined, quote, U.S. to provide Israel with modern weapons to face, quote, possible war with Iran, and appeared on June 8th when I found it on an Israeli intelligence website. According to the article, quote, security sources in Tel Aviv revealed the approval of U.S. President Donald Trump of a broad plan to strengthen the capabilities of the Israeli army to meet the threat of a possible war with Iran. The plan includes increasing the number of U.S. military units in Israel and expanding them regularly and strengthening Israel's defense capability to surpass Iranian ballistic missiles, the sources said. In addition, Trump canceled the decision by former President Barack Obama to block refueling planes from Israel. He even decided to reverse it in supplying the Israeli Air Force with a large number of Boeing KC-46 refueling aircraft, which would enable the Israeli Army and Air Force to operate longer and more flexibly against targets far from Israel. Israeli sources, according to the article, pointed out that Obama at the time refused to supply Israel with an additional number of these aircraft, part of his policy to reduce the Israeli military capabilities to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. The new Trump resolution, it said, was made in response to NATO's well-known position expressed by Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, in which he said NATO would not help Israel if it came under Iranian attack, stressing that the central objective was to achieve an international consensus on Iran's exit from Syria, end quote. If you're listening closely, you heard me mention that, quote, the plan includes increasing the number of U.S. military units in Israel, end quote. Were you aware or have you read or heard about U.S. military units in Israel? I suspect not. But last September 18th, the Washington-based online publication The Hill reported on the opening of the first permanent U.S. military base in Israel, and despite other articles about it on military and defense websites, not a single other U.S. media outlet chose to report it. On that September day, The Hill reported that, quote, Israel and U.S. officials on Monday inaugurated the first permanent American military base in the country, which will house dozens of U.S. troops and a missile defense system. The base will be located within the Israel Defense Forces Air Defense School in southern Israel, near Beersheba, said the article, citing Defense News. The facility will include a barracks and several other buildings for U.S. troops to be stationed in the country, as well as systems to identify and intercept various aerial threats. And get this, quote, it will operate under Israeli military directives. You heard me correctly. The U.S. base and the U.S. troops on it will be under the control of the Israel Defense Forces. Israeli Air Force General Zvika Hamovich said the base is largely to serve as a, quote, a joint Israeli and American effort to sustain and enhance our defensive capabilities. It's a message that says Israel is better prepared. It's a message that says Israel is improving the response to threats, Hamovich, the commander of Israel's aerial defense, told the Associated Press. There is, of course, a more serious message that should concern every American. Should Israel decide to launch an aerial attack on Hezbollah in Lebanon, which it is threatened to do, and should Hezbollah respond with rockets targeting Israel, as happened in 2006, and should one of those missiles or rockets hit the U.S. base and kill or seriously injure a U.S. serviceman, you can be assured the U.S. military would then join the war on the side of Israel. The report on the U.S. Special Operations website made that clear, quote, While both U.S. and Israeli commanders stated that the timing of the pact between the two countries doesn't tie into any specific events, the message is clear. Iran, who has been stockpiling rockets for their Hezbollah proxies across the border in Lebanon, as well as Gaza, has been put on notice, end quote. In other words, should Israel launch an attack on Iran, which it was close to doing some years back, and should Iran respond with missiles, as could be expected, the U.S. would then become a partner in another devastating war of Israel's choosing. President Trump speaks of the importance of national sovereignty. Well, it seems that is what he has given away in response to the demands of his apparent boss, the avidly pro-Israel multi-billionaire Sheldon Adelson, who has given over $35 million to the president and many millions more to the Republican Party. But that's Trump and the military. What is a failure of the U.S. media to inform the American people about this qualitative and dangerous change in our relationship with Israel? What does it tell us other than like the White House, like Congress, like most of our state legislatures, including California, it too is under Israel's thumb? Moving us closer to a war footing, the New York Times reports today that any nation found buying Iranian oil will be subject to sanctions after November 4th, which, unlike in previous administrations, certain countries like China and Japan were granted waivers. This time they say the Bush administration will not be doing that, moving us ever closer to war. Today, as improbable as anything that has happened since the election of Donald Trump, his national security advisor John Bolton is in Moscow to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, ostensibly to plan for a meeting between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in July. And that's the way it's being reported in the British and U.S. press. In Russia, the RIA news agency cited Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov as saying that Russian officials hope to discuss with Bolton the situation in Syria in wake of the developments in the southern Dara province. He stressed it was important for this file to be discussed on the bilateral Russian-American level ahead of tackling it with Jordan. That longtime neocon and war hawk Bolton should be a partner in such discussions would ordinarily be unimaginable, but these are far from ordinary times, and few things are what they seem to be. A Russian diplomat told the Saudi-owned Ashraq al-Assad that Moscow is seeking to put the finishing touches to a tripartite agreement to ensure the stability of southern Syria. He revealed that Russia had addressed the issue with Israel and several understandings were reached between them over ending the Iranian presence in the south. Another site quoted a senior Israeli Air Force officer as saying that Israeli jets have, quote, maintained our freedom of action over Syria, end quote, continuing to strike targets in the war-torn country, and stressed that Israel will continue to work with, quote, determination to thwart the entrenchment of Iran and the army of Hezbollah. Iranian resolve in the region continues, he said, and we will keep operating and disrupting under the war threshold, which I should add has only been possible with Putin's permission. The timing of the summit, according to the London Daily Telegraph, has raised questions about whether Trump, who bragged this month about bringing the 2026 World Cup in North America, could defy expectations and visit the Russian capital for the final match of the 2018 tournament. Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu is also considering coming to the game, and his Palestinian puppet Mahmoud Abbas, a notorious freeloader, has already accepted an invitation from Putin to attend, raising the possibility, suggests the Telegraph, of an Israeli-Palestinian summit at the international sporting event. That would be something to see. One of the things that doomed former General Michael Flynn, Trump's first national security advisor, and before that the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency under Obama, was an interview he had given on Al Jazeera in which he accused the Obama administration, along with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, of helping to foment the rise of an Islamic State in Syria to counter President Bashar al-Assad, to which he had stated his objections and which I had reported on Takes on the World. That aspect of Flynn's activities, many of whom were questionable, was ignored by the mainstream media, which was largely kept silent about the U.S. role in creating ISIS. In an interview titled Confronting the Consequences of Obama's Foreign Policy, The Intercept's Mehdi Hassan questioned Ben Rhodes, Obama's longtime deputy national security advisor, who is currently promoting his newly published book, the world as it is inside the Obama White House. Rose has been described as being so trusted and close to Obama that he was in the room for almost every foreign policy decision of significance that Obama made during his 8 years in office. In the wide-ranging interview, when pushed to make a definitive answer about the U.S. role in Syria under Obama, he eventually answers in the affirmative when Mehdi Hassan asked the following question about supporting jihadists in Syria. "Did you intervene too much in Syria?" he asked, "because the CIA spent hundreds of millions of dollars funding and arming anti-Assad rebels. A lot of those arms, as you know, ended up in the hands of jihadist groups, some even in the hands of ISIS. Your critics would say you exacerbated that proxy war in Syria," he tells Rhodes. "You prolonged the conflict in Syria. You ended up bolstering jihadists." Rhodes tries to evade answering and second-guessing Syria policy, but Hassan is persistent. "Oh, come on, but you were coordinating a lot of arms." The two argue over Hassan's charge of bolstering jihadists, at the end of which Rhodes reluctantly answers, "Yeah," but while trying to pass ultimate blame onto U.S. allies, Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. Vice President Joe Biden did the same in 2014. Hassan replied, "Oh, come on, but you were coordinating a lot of their arms. You know, the U.S. was heavily involved in that war with the Saudis and the Qataris and Turks." "Well, I was going to say Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi," Rhodes responds. "You were in there as well," retorts Hassan. "Yeah," Rhodes finally acknowledges, "but the fact of the matter is that once it kind of developed into a kind of a sectarian-based civil war with different sides fighting for their survival, I think we, the ability to bring the type of situation to close, and part of what I wrestle with in the book is the limits of our ability to pull a lever and make killing like that stop once it's underway," end quote. That's Ben Rhodes admitting to Intercept report in Mehdi Hassan that in Syria, the Obama administration had become involved with in not having helped to start something that it was unable to stop and continues to this day. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي فوسا قزح طفلة تمتطي فوسا قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sherif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The demonstrations continue at the barrier fence along the Israeli-Gaza border, and the slaughter of Palestinians continues. This morning we want to take a look at the brutality of the Israeli weaponry, the excessive force being used, the use of high-powered sniper rifles at short range, along with the use of dum-dum bullets that explode as they enter the body, tearing flesh and deliberately causing massive wounds. We start with a report from the Real News Network, an interview with a German reporter by the name of Shir Hever, who has studied the use of Israeli weaponry along the border.
It's the Real News. I'm Ben Norton. The Great March of Return has continued in Gaza now for 11 weeks. Palestinians are holding regular demonstrations along the Gaza fence, protesting the crippling Israeli siege and the illegal denial of their basic rights under international law. The current death toll stands at 129 unarmed protesters who were gunned down by Israeli forces since March 30th, with many thousands more wounded by live ammunition. The Israeli Air Force pounded the Gaza Strip over the weekend, but no casualties were reported. Meanwhile, the thousands of injured protesters are more than the health facilities in Gaza can handle. Medical staff have repeatedly warned that protesters are arriving at the hospitals with severe wounds that are signs that the Israeli army is likely using munitions that are prohibited under the Geneva Convention. Israel continues to deny entry to patients in need of medical attention. Many of the protesters have had their limbs amputated. Well, joining us to discuss this issue is Shir Hever. Shir is the Real News correspondent in Heidelberg, Germany. He has a PhD in political science from the Free University in Berlin, and his most recent book is The Privatization of Israeli Security, which was published by Pluto Press in 2017. Thanks for joining us, Shir.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So what do we actually know about the kind of ammunition which Israeli snipers are using against Palestinians in Gaza? There are reports that the IDF is actually using expanding bullets, which are known as dum-dum bullets.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we don't know the full facts. And the medical staff in Gaza, what they lack in order to conduct a proper investigation of the ammunition that is used is the cases of the bullets. And those stay, of course, on the Israeli side when the bullets are fired. But there is a very interesting report that was written by Avichai Stolar, who is a former Israeli soldier, a member of the organization Breaking the Silence. And he analyzed a lot of pictures showing Israeli soldiers using various sniper rifles, firing at Palestinians, trying to identify what kind of ammunition these weapons can use. And he says, well, one possibility is that the Israeli army are using dum-dum bullets or hollow point bullets, which expand in the wound, and they are indeed prohibited by law. But the problem with this analysis is that it doesn't make a lot of sense that Israeli soldiers would be equipped with those kinds of bullets for this sort of mission to fire at unarmed protesters approaching the fence. It wouldn't serve any tactical or strategic purpose for the Israeli military. But he offers another interpretation. And the other interpretation that I think is very interesting and also very convincing is that, in fact, these sniper rifles, which are produced mainly by American companies, by Remington and Knight's Ammunition Company, they are sniper rifles which are designed to use at a certain range. And what the Israeli soldiers are doing, they're using the rifles at very close range, with a few tens of meters. And at those ranges, even regular bullets can cause these expanding wounds, which are very, very damaging to living tissues and can cause irreparable damage to limbs. And that's why so many Palestinians are so seriously injured. And I think then this, of course, raises the question, why are Israeli soldiers using sniper rifles at such short range when we know that they have also alternatives like Ruger rifles, which are specifically designed to disperse demonstrations and to be used in non-combat situations?
Yeah, you raised a few important points there. One, we have to stress that these are U.S.-made weapons, and the U.S. gives $3.8 billion every year in military assistance to Israel. And also, you did say that there might be no military purpose, but what if the political purpose is simply to wound and maim as many Palestinians as possible to discourage them from protesting?
I think there is absolutely no shortage of ability for the Israeli military to cause pain, suffering, and death to Palestinians. The Hamas party used to have on their charter, they changed the text a little bit, a call to wipe out Israel. And there is also an Israeli minister, Yuval Steinitz, the minister of energy, who just said 2 weeks ago that Israel should consider eliminating Gaza. His statement is much more scary than the Hamas statement because his side actually has the weapons to do it. There is no problem for the Israeli military to kill and maim as many Palestinians as they want in terms of their physical ability to do so. But why would they then go about and do it using this kind of prohibited ammunition, the dum-dum rounds and so on, when they could, for example, use other kinds of ammunition that we know they possess, such as scatter bombs and phosphorus bombs, which they have used before. So I think there is an issue here that needs to be explained. And And also I wanted to say something about the point that these are American weapons. Of course, the United States bears a lot of responsibility for arming the occupying power with weapons that are used in the regular violation of human rights and war crimes. But I'm also interested in looking at it through the angle of the Israeli arms industry. When we look at the previous attacks on Gaza, starting from 2006, 2008, 2012, 2014, the Israeli military has specifically showcased their use of Israeli weapons in these attacks because they want to sell them, because they turn the Gaza Strip into a laboratory for Israeli weaponry. And so after every attack in Gaza, then they show videos of how they used Israeli weapons, and then they use those videos to try to convince customers to buy the weapons. This time, we don't see that, because they're using American weapons. They're using Remington and Knight's armament company sniper rifles. Also a few Israeli sniper rifles, but those are not really showcased so much. And they're not using the Israeli, flagship weapons like the drones, which are their main exports. This shows that the Israeli strategy of using the Gaza Strip as a laboratory is collapsing. And we have to understand what kind of strategy have Palestinians developed that is preventing the Israeli government from benefiting from the siege on Gaza.
You have been listening to a report by the Real News Network out of Baltimore concerning the use of excessive weaponry by the Israeli military along the Gaza barrier fence. And now on to our feature presentation, which this week is a speech given at the Spring Conference of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs by Professor John Mearsheimer. It is an assessment of the status of the Israeli lobby today. Professor Mearsheimer is introduced by Janet McMahon of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs.
Hello, I'm Janet McMahon, and the managing editor of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. I was out at the registration table trying to help sign people in when Dale started speaking, so I don't know if he told you, but the Washington Report will be 35 years old next month. Yeah. And we have been following the Israel lobby since our very first issue in 1982. So it's a special pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker, Professor John Mearsheimer. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. In March of 2006, he and Professor Stephen Walt of Harvard published an article in the London Review of Books titled The Israel Lobby. The article had originally been commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly, but that American publication decided not to publish it after all. So instead, it found a home overseas. The paper's publication caused an uproar, in no small part because it shed light on what AIPAC operative Steve Rosen described as a night flower that thrives in the dark and shrivels up in the sunlight. Harvard posted the paper on its website but removed its logo. And attacks on Mearsheimer and Walt ranged from naive, that from Noam Chomsky, to, and this will shock you, anti-Semites. The following year, their article evolved into the book The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which has since been translated into 22 languages. Professor Mearsheimer, by the way, will be signing copies of his book at 12:15 at the registration table where you signed in. I'm also particularly glad that he is joining us today because every year people ask us if he is going to be speaking at our conference. So it's been a great pleasure this year to be able to say, of course he is. Today he will be discussing what, if anything, has changed in the decades since the Israel Lobby was published. Please join me in welcoming Professor John Mearsheimer.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here today to speak before this distinguished audience. I would like to thank IRMEP and the Washington Report for inviting me to give this talk. Of course, I thank all of you for coming out to hear me and the other speakers. I would like to focus my talk on what has transpired regarding the Israel lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship in the 10 years since Steve Walt and I wrote The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. My talk's comprised of four parts. I'll begin by briefly restating the core arguments in our book. I'll then describe four major changes that have taken place regarding the lobby and the U.S.-Israeli relationship over the past decade. I will then describe what has not changed and conclude by speculating about the future. The central argument in the book is that the United States has a special relationship with Israel that has no parallel in modern history, and it is almost wholly due to the lobby. What makes Israel's relationship with the United States extraordinary is not simply the fact that Israel has received more foreign aid than any other country, or that Washington almost always backs Israel diplomatically. What makes it truly special is that the aid is given unconditionally. In other words, Israel gets this aid even when it does things that the United States opposes, like building settlements in the West Bank. This discussion raises the obvious question: why does the United States give Israel so much aid and without any conditions? Israel's supporters sometimes argue that it is because Israel is a vital strategic asset. This is not a serious argument. In fact, giving Israel nearly unconditional support is one of the reasons we have a terrorism problem. Others argue that there's a moral rationale for the special relationship. Israel is said to be a democracy that shares our values. The two countries certainly share some values, but Israel is a Jewish state which clearly privileges its Jewish citizens. Non-Jews are second-class citizens in both theory and practice. The United States, on the other hand, is a liberal democracy that works hard to treat all of its citizens equally. It certainly is not a Christian state that treats non-Christians as second-class citizens. Indeed, that kind of discrimination, which is part of Israel's essence, is antithetical to the American way of life. Furthermore, Israel's treatment of the Palestinians in the occupied territories is sharply at odds with U.S. values. Finally, there's the claim that the American people have such a favorable view of Israel that they demand their politicians back the special relationship. This argument, however, is not persuasive. If you look at the survey data on how the American public thinks about Israel, as Grant made clear before I spoke, there's no question that Americans have a generally favorable image of Israel, in part because media coverage tends to be favorable. But as poll after poll shows, that support is not especially deep or wide. So what explains the special relationship if there is no strategic or moral imperative, and if most Americans do not favor it? Our answer, of course, is the lobby. What exactly is the lobby? Steve and I argue that it's a loose coalition of individuals and groups who actively work to influence U.S. foreign policy in a pro-Israel direction. It's not a centralized organization, and the groups that make up the lobby do not agree on every issue. It includes organizations like AIPAC, the Anti-Defamation League, the Conference of Presidents, the Zionist Organization of America, and Christians United for Israel, just to name a few. It also includes think tanks like YNAP and the American Enterprise Institute, and publications like the Weekly Standard and Commentary. It certainly is not a cabal or a conspiracy that, quote-unquote, controls U.S. foreign policy. Rather, it's a powerful interest group like the NRA, the Farm Lobby, the Cuba Lobby, or the AARP. And it operates pretty much the same way those other interest groups do. Very importantly, the lobby is not synonymous with Jewish Americans. Surveys suggest that about a third of American Jews do not care that much about Israel. Others do not support the lobby's positions. And some groups that work on Israel's behalf, such as the so-called Christian Zionists, are not Jewish. In short, the lobby is defined by its political agenda, not by ethnicity or religion. Finally, we argue that the lobby has pushed policies that are in neither Israel's or America's national interests. In particular, we maintain that it would have been much better for both countries if the United States had long ago pressured Israel to stop building settlements and allow for the creation of a viable Palestinian state. But this did not happen, and it will not happen, because the lobby makes it impossible for American leaders to use the leverage at their disposal to pressure Israel. In essence, that's the story Steve and I tell. Let me now switch gears and talk about what has changed regarding Israel and the lobby since the book was first published in 2007. I think that there have been four noteworthy changes. First, there has been a fundamental change in how Americans think and talk about Israel, the special relationship, and the lobby. When we initially wrote our book, there was much ignorance about these subjects. And my sense is that most people who read our book or who have read our book thought there was a large element of truth in what we said, but that we had nevertheless exaggerated the lobby's influence. There was also a great deal of ignorance in the American body politic about Israeli policies, especially toward the Palestinians, and little understanding of the special relationship. This is hardly surprising because one of the lobby's main goals is to prevent an open conversation in the media about Israeli policy, the U.S.-Israeli relationship, and the lobby itself. It was successful for a long time, but my sense from talking to many people about these matters and from closely following the public discourse is that those days are over. For example, it's commonplace, even in the mainstream media, to talk about the lobby using just that word. And I cannot tell you how many people have said to me that, if anything, Steve and I just scratched the surface in our discussion of the lobby's power and influence. I might add that there is now more discussion of Israel's policies and actions in the American media. And if you read the comments section that follow many newspaper stories, you will see that there are a substantial number of Americans who are critical of Israeli behavior, especially toward the Palestinians. And only someone who is blind and deaf would not recognize that the United States is deeply committed to defending Israel's behavior at almost every turn. In short, there is much more awareness of these critical issues today than there was a decade ago. What's caused this change? I think that our original article and the book helped. Both attracted an enormous amount of attention. Indeed, the lobby book made the New York Times bestseller list, and because of the internet, the article on which the book was based was widely read all over the world. But I think that ultimately our arguments would not have had much impact were it not for a number of other factors. First, the actions of Israel and the lobby over the past decade have done much to substantiate many of the claims we made in the book. Just to take one example, consider how Israel and the lobby responded to the Iran nuclear deal. Prime Minister Netanyahu went to extraordinary lengths to sabotage the agreement, going so far as to give a speech to a joint session of Congress on March 3, 2015, that not only sought to undermine the deal, but was also an indirect attack on President Obama. Of course, he was aided by AIPAC, which went all out to defeat the deal. This nasty fight between Netanyahu and the lobby on one hand and the Obama administration on the other hand played out in full public view. The second factor behind the increased awareness of Israeli policy and the lobby is the internet and social media. There are now all sorts of places on the Internet one can go to for information about these subjects. The website Mondo Weiss, which I am sure everyone in this room knows about, is a case in point. It posts a steady stream of stories that reveal important information about Israeli policy and the lobby's activities, not to mention critical assessments of those matters. Mondo Weiss, which is now 11 years old, had 8 million visits to its site in 2016. Of course, there are other sites that provide valuable information, like the Electronic Intifada, which is run by Ali Abu Neiba, and the site for the Israeli magazine Plus972. Another important source of information on the Internet is Haaretz, the liberal Israeli newspaper, which often runs pieces that take a critical perspective on Israel as well as the lobby. And in the age of Twitter, important pieces that appear on these sites are immediately spread around the world to huge numbers of people. These same pieces are also circulated on email lists that go to hundreds, if not thousands, of interested readers. Third, there are a host of organizations that are willing to criticize Israel and the lobby. IRMEP is a case in point, as it has played an important role in exposing the lobby's activities over time. There are also a number of organizations that are deeply committed to Israel, which nevertheless are willing to take Israel to task when they disapprove of its behavior. They include J Street, Jewish Voice for Peace, Americans for Peace Now, and the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, among others. Finally, there are some important voices in the mainstream media who have taken to speaking critically about Israeli policy and the lobby. The most important person in this regard is Peter Beinart, who wrote a very influential article in the June 2010 issue of the New York Review of Books entitled "The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment," which is critical of the lobby for aiding and abetting Israel's misguided policies in the occupied territories. He has continued to write and speak about these matters since this article appeared. And before Beinhart, there was the late Tony Judt, who offered searing criticisms of Israel and its American defenders. Of course, there are a number of other key figures in the mainstream media who have occasionally taken aim at both Israel and the lobby over the past decade. They would include Roger Cohen, Thomas Friedman, and Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, as well as Jon Stewart of Daily Show fame. In sum, I think there has been a significant change in how Americans think and talk about Israel since our book appeared. The second big change is that Israel's image in the West, especially in the United States, has suffered serious damage over the past decade. This is due in part to the fact that information about Israel is more readily available now than it was in the past, thanks in good part to the Internet and social media, but it is also a result of the fact that things have been changing inside of Israel in recent years. For starters, the political center of gravity in Israel has been moving steadily rightward for decades, and it has now reached the point where government ministers occasionally make racist comments about Palestinians and write legislation that is directly at odds with basic liberal values. The recent legislation banning individuals who support BDS from entering Israel is the latest example of this phenomenon. All indications are that this rightward shift will continue for the foreseeable future, and Israel will become an increasingly illiberal country, even towards its own citizens. But the key stain on Israel's reputation is its brutal treatment of the Palestinians and the fact that it has become an apartheid state. Until recently, Israel and its supporters were able to maintain the fiction that there would eventually be a legitimate Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. But it is now clear that there is virtually no chance that will happen, and Greater Israel is here to stay. And that Greater Israel as Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley make clear in an important new UN study, is already an apartheid state. Israel and its defenders vehemently deny that fact, but even among Israelis, it's not unusual to hear Israel described in as apartheid state. For example, two former Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, have said that if there is no two-state solution, there will be, Israel will, to quote Olmert, face a South African-style struggle. Well, there is no two-state solution. Speaking of South Africa, there are a number of individuals who were well acquainted with the situation in that racist state before it collapsed, who believe that the situation in Israel is worse. John Duggard, the eminent South African law professor, says that the crimes against the Palestinians are, to quote him, infinitely worse than those committed by the apartheid regime in South Africa, end of quote. He is hardly the lone voice in that regard. For anyone who doubts how bad life can be for the Palestinians living under Israeli control, one only has to consider what happened in Israel's three major assaults against Gaza over the past decade, Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense, and Operation Protective Edge. Because of time constraints, I will focus exclusively on the first of those operations, Cast Lead, which took place in the weeks before President Obama was inaugurated in 2009. Israeli forces killed about 1,400 Palestinians, of whom roughly 1,200 were civilians. 350 of those civilians were children. In contrast, 13 Israelis were killed. The ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed in that operation is 108-1. That's not a war in my lexicon. That's a massacre. I might add that 6,300 Palestinian homes were destroyed, contributing to the 600,000 tons of rubble that littered Gaza when the shooting ended. The UN commissioned an investigation in the wake of that conflict, which was headed by the distinguished South African jurist Richard Goldstone. The final report concluded that Israel had engaged in, quote, a deliberately disproportionate attack designed to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population, end of quote. It went on to accuse Israel of committing war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. There are other signs of serious trouble in Israel. Especially worrisome are the racist attitudes among large segments of Jewish Israeli youth. Given these attitudes, it is hardly surprising that a year ago today, a young Israeli soldier shot and killed a wounded and defenseless Palestinian. Equally unsurprising, there was a huge outcry in Israel when he was indicted and later convicted of the reduced charge of manslaughter. Press reports from Israel make it clear that many Israelis thought his behavior was justified and that it was hardly an isolated incident. He simply had the misfortune of getting caught on film. The fact that the shooting was captured on film virtually guaranteed that it would go viral on social media and further damage Israel's image. The bottom line is that the days when Israel was seen as a morally upright David taking on an evil Goliath are over. The damage to Israel's reputation probably started in 1982 when it invaded Lebanon. But it has accelerated at a marked pace over the past decade. The third big change involves changes within the American Jewish community. One of the most important developments in recent years is a shift in the balance of power between the mainstream organizations in the lobby that reflexively support Israel's policies towards the Palestinians and a more progressive set of organizations that are determined to find a way to make peace between the two sides. The divide between those groups has long been present, but the balance of power between them has always been lopsided in favor of the organizations that support Israel no matter what it does. That situation, however, has begun to change, especially with the rise of J Street, which was created in November 2007 as a home for individuals with progressive views on Israel. It not only has a high profile, but it also is willing to criticize Israeli policies in the occupied territories and actually take on the hardline organizations in the lobby. J Street is surely not as powerful as an organization like AIPAC, but the mere fact that it has survived and is thriving shows that times are changing. After all, a similar organization called BRERA was established in 1973, but the mainline forces in the lobby quickly crushed it. Not only has J Street survived, but there is good reason to think that it will grow in strength over time as increasing numbers of American Jews look to join institutions that challenge Israel's repressive policies towards the Palestinians. In addition to these changes in the Jewish establishment, there are changes taking place in the broader American Jewish community that do not bode well for either the lobby or Israel. In particular, it seems clear that younger Jews are not as committed to Israel as their parents and grandparents. For example, a Pew survey from 2013 found that among Jews who are 65 years or older, 53% say that caring about Israel is essential to being what Jewish means to me. That's 65 years or older, 53%. In contrast, 32% of American Jews under the age of 30 held a similar view. That is a gap of 21 percentage points. It seems likely that support for Israel in the American Jewish community, which has been weakening over the past decade, will weaken even more in the years ahead as generational change continues. Lastly, there's been an important change in Israel's support within the United States. For purposes of background, it's important to reemphasize that public support for Israel in the United States has never been particularly strong. One way that the lobby deals with this thin support is to have significant influence both inside the Democratic and Republican parties. In essence, the lobby has worked hard to make sure that Israel enjoys strong bipartisan support and is not strongly backed in one of the major parties, but not the other. The lobby was successful in this regard for a long time. But that bipartisan support has begun to erode over the past decade as support for Israel inside the Democratic Party has plummeted. At the same time, it has grown substantially inside the Republican Party. In a Pew poll from this past January, only 33% of Democrats said they sympathize more with the Israelis than the Palestinians, while 74% of Republicans said they sympathize more with Israel than the Palestinians. This is a gap of 41 percentage points. In short, there has been a marked erosion in support for Israel within the Democratic Party in recent years, which raises serious questions as to whether the lobby will be able to maintain bipartisan support for the special relationship in the years ahead. Let me switch gears again and now focus on what has not changed over the past decade. Three things have not changed. First, the lobby is as powerful as ever. One might be tempted to see the lobby's defeat on the Iran nuclear issue as evidence that its power is waning. But that would be a mistake. The lobby does not win every time, and it is most likely to lose when it is pushing the United States to do something that might get it into a war. The Iran deal fits squarely in that category, as failure to make a deal with Tehran would have sharply increased the chances that the United States would have attacked Iran's nuclear facilities. Where the lobby almost always wins is on matters relating to the Palestinians and financial support for Israel. The fact that the Obama administration could do virtually nothing to get Israel to move toward a two-state solution, yet still opted to provide Israel with $38 billion in aid over the next decade, is clear evidence that the lobby remains very powerful. It's important to understand that the key to the lobby's success is that it focuses mainly on influencing high-level policymakers and opinion makers, as well as the elites in both political parties, not the rank and file. I noted earlier that there has been a significant decrease in support for Israel within the Democratic Party. The reason that change has had little effect on policy is that the elites in the Democratic Party remain deeply committed to the special relationship. They fear the lobby will target them if there is any evidence they are wavering in their support for Israel. One might think that politicians who are supposed to place the American national interest above the interest of all other countries would stand up to the lobby when it pushes policies that they know are not good for the United States. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates explains why this does not happen. I saw most of Congress as uncivil, incompetent at fulfilling their basic constitutional responsibility, micromanagerial, parochial, hypocritical, egotistical, thin-skinned, and here are the key words, and prone to put self and re-election before country. The second big non-change is that U.S. policy toward Israel remains the same as it has been for the past decade. The special relationship, in other words, is firmly intact. Of course, this continuity is hardly surprising, given that there has been no diminishment in the power of the lobby. As many of you probably remember, there was a brief moment during the recent presidential election when it looked like candidate Trump might favor a more even-handed approach to dealing with Israel and the Palestinians. But he quickly reversed field and made it clear that he would go to great lengths to be even more pro-Israel than President Obama. Naturally, Hillary Clinton made the same pledge. Thus, there's no good reason to think that American policy toward Israel is going to change in a meaningful way anytime soon. Finally, there is hardly any sustained criticism of Israel in the American foreign policy establishment. This, too, is unsurprising, since the lobby is as powerful as ever, and as I emphasized, it focuses most of its attention on keeping the country's elites in line. Anyone who wants to be a serious player in the making of U.S. foreign policy understands full well that if he or she criticizes Israel, there will be a price to pay. The result is that there is no serious debate about Israel or the special relationship in Congress, the mainstream media, or prominent think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations. This is not to deny, however, that there is an open and vigorous discussion of Israel and its relationship with the United States outside of these establishment institutions. Let me conclude by talking about where we go from here. I believe dark times are ahead for both Israel and the lobby. There's no reason to think Israel is going to move toward a two-state solution. Greater Israel is here to stay, and that state is and will remain an apartheid state. That brute fact will become increasingly clear to people all over the world, especially now that it is clear the Palestinians are not going to get a state of their own. Moreover, the Palestinians, who already comprise almost half of the population of Greater Israel, will continue to resist their oppression, which will force Israel to escalate the repressive policies that have already badly tarnished its image. The Palestinians' most potent weapon in this fight will be BDS, which is a global movement that aims to generate significant economic and political pressure on Israel that will ultimately force it to give the Palestinians equal rights. Israel and its supporters in the West view BDS as an existential threat because it not only has the potential to delegitimize Israel, but it might ultimately lead to Israel's undoing. After all, the Palestinians, if they were given equal rights, Israel would cease to be a Jewish state, as there eventually will be more Palestinians than Jews inside of Greater Israel. And there are good reasons to think that BDS might succeed, at least when it comes to delegitimizing Israel. First, it takes dead aim at apartheid, which is a morally repugnant political system that is universally condemned. Apartheid South Africa eventually disappeared. Why should Israel be any different? Second, the call to give the Palestinians equal rights is fully consistent with basic Western values. It's a demand that will surely resonate in Western Europe and the United States, causing all sorts of problems for Israel and its supporters. Of course, Israel and its supporters are counting on the lobby to stymie BDS. Over time, however, that will become an increasingly difficult task, simply because there is no good defense for apartheid, which is a reprehensible political system. Nevertheless, the lobby is extraordinarily powerful, and it will go to enormous lengths to protect Israel at every turn. It's difficult to say where this conflict will lead in the decades ahead. Many Israelis will surely be interested in expelling the Palestinians from Greater Israel if they have the opportunity, thereby eliminating the need for apartheid. But that outcome is unlikely because there are now more than 6 million Palestinians living within Greater Israel's borders, and they would surely put up fierce resistance if Israel tried to expel them from their homes. Moreover, massive ethnic cleansing would be an enormous and everlasting stain on Israel's reputation. It's more likely that Israel will simply remain an apartheid state and will help, and with the help of the lobby, just hunker down and accept the fact that most of the world considers it a pariah state. Finally, there's the possibility that BDS will carry the day and Greater Israel will become a legitimate liberal democracy. If that were to happen, which is not likely, it would undoubtedly come after much bloodshed, as most Israeli Jews would fervently oppose this outcome, since it would mean the end of the Zionist dream. Again, it's hard to say which one of these outcomes will carry the day. It will probably take another 20 or 30 years before we understand how this conflict will ultimately be resolved, or maybe not resolved. Regardless of the outcome, I am deeply sad to say that the decades ahead promise abundant trouble for Israel and especially for the Palestinians. And the United States will not be spared either, simply because the lobby will be working overtime to protect Israel and preserve the special relationship, which is likely to harm America's intellectual life as well as its politics.
You have been listening to an assessment of the status of the Israeli lobby by Professor John Mearsheimer, who literally, along with Stephen Wall, wrote the book on the matter. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, the weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m., You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org or listen to us later in the day or at any other time via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is only on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent archive, to hear all our past broadcasts, access truthandjusticeradio.org on your browser. That is all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters in Politics. On today's show,
they almost come to the center of the structures of power in 18th century Britain. They set up banks that become really important to the financing of war. You know, and this is one thing that Galton points out when everyone suddenly becomes upset with his business in the Quaker Church. He says, well, okay, I'm making guns, but you have a bank that's involved that helps the government prosecute its wars. And, you know, you produce iron that I use in my guns. So how are you any different from me? So what he sees when he looks at his Quaker network is, you know, everyone implicated in some way, and how is he any worse?
A conversation on Samuel Galton Jr., one of the first large gun manufacturers, who had also become a banker. We'll talk about the connection of gun manufacturing to the financial world, to colonialism, and also to slavery, and how all of these things are still connected to the financial world today. Our guest is Priya Setia. Priya Setia is a professor of history at Stanford University and author of the book Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. That's next on Letters in Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is pushing back against the argument that he should wait until after the midterm election to hold a confirmation hearing on whomever President Trump nominates to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Democrats have cited McConnell's refusal to hold a hearing on President Obama's 2016 nominee to the court, Merrick Garland. That left Donald Trump to nominate Neil Gorsuch. But McConnell said that was different.
This is not 2016. There aren't the final months of a second-term constitutionally lame-duck presidency with a presidential election fast approaching. We're right in the middle of this president's very first term. To my knowledge, nobody on either side has ever suggested before yesterday that the Senate should only process Supreme Court nominations in odd-numbered years.
Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called on McConnell to postpone the confirmation process, saying to move forward with it would be an act of hypocrisy.
Millions of people are just months away from determining the senators who should vote to confirm or reject the president's nominee, and their voices deserve to be heard now, as Leader McConnell thought they should deserve to be heard then. Anything but that would be the absolute height of hypocrisy.
Organizers of the Women's March are preparing to hold a mass civil disobedience action at the Capitol, demanding Congress act to end policies that criminalize undocumented immigrants and incarcerate children. Ana Maria Chilla is co-executive director at the Center for Popular Democracy. She said women should not remain silent in the aftermath of separated families dramatized by the audio of young children sobbing for their parents.
Women who say we do not obey injustice, we do not obey racism, we do not obey bigotry, we do not sit down when our families are being attacked. Is that right?
Protesters are blocking the streets in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Donald Trump stayed overnight. They're chanting on behalf of immigrant children the Trump administration separated from their parents.
What do we want? Our children!
When do we want it?
Now!
Trump held a morning fundraising event in Milwaukee, a prelude to the groundbreaking he's attending for a factory for Foxconn, a manufacturing partner of Apple. Foxconn has promised 13,000 jobs. In exchange, it has extracted $4 billion in state and local subsidies, working out to more than $300,000 in government subsidies for every promised job. Federal officials in Portland moved to reopen a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement ICE office that was closed for more than a week because of an occupation by activists. A Federal Protective Services spokesperson said in a statement that law enforcement began clearing a camp of demonstrators at dawn. Media reports say officers took some protesters into custody. The group Occupy ICE PDX began its round-the-clock demonstration June 17th, calling for the abolition of ICE and an end to the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy. A Brazilian woman seeking asylum in the U.S. says she's hopeful a federal judge will order the release of her 9-year-old son from detention in Chicago. Lydia Karine Sousa was separated from her son Diogo at the border in May. Her son has been held at a government-contracted shelter for 4 weeks. Sousa was released from a Texas detention facility June 9th. After the hearing, Sousa told reporters she's confident her lawsuit will succeed, but that the wait is heartbreaking. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and FBI Director Christopher Wray are facing sharp questions from Republicans. Republicans are accusing them of withholding important documents and demanding details about surveillance tactics during the Russia investigation. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee contend the department has conspired against Donald Trump. That's a charge frequently repeated by the president. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jesrich. Samuel Galton Jr. is one of the largest and earliest gun manufacturers of the 18th century in Birmingham, England. Through the fortune he amassed by selling his guns to an eager British empire wishing to buy them, Samuel Galton and his family would also become some of the earliest financial giants and created banks whose vestiges can still be found today in such large institutions as HSBC. Samuel Galton was also a Quaker. And pacifism is a main tenet for Quakers, and this would get him in trouble with his own church, which he was a prominent member of. Today we're going to be in conversation about this story and how the manufacturing of guns, colonialism, and slavery were tied up into the Industrial Revolution and how they're still tied into our financial world today. My guest is Priya Setia. Priya Setia is a professor of history at Stanford University, and she is the author of the book Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Priya Setia, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station.
Thank you, Mitch, for having me.
Now, before we get to the beginning of this relationship to guns, industrialization, empire, slavery, the financial world, all these things, first lay out for me right now, how are guns still tied into our financial world today?
In general, we've known this for a long time. People have talked about a military-industrial complex, for instance, for decades. The firearms industry is part of that complex. It's kind of hard not to talk about the beginnings because I think the relationship is historical, and there's a historical entwinement between financial institutions, government institutions, and sometimes specific companies, but generally also entire industries that are related to production of material for war. And so if you look at today, for instance, major banking institutions that are involved in financing the government are also involved in financing the firearms industry and are also consumer banks, the banks that we go to. And part of this is just the concentration of some of these industries, whether it's finance or firearms, but the new tech giants as well are also really concentrated. And that concentration is also why it's hard to get away from origins, because some of these are very, very storied, very historic companies that have been with us since the beginning of the industrial age. And that's why it's so difficult to extricate them from one another. Like the state institutions we have evolved in tandem with and entangled with the financial institutions that we have today and some of the other industries and companies that we have today.
It's easy to villainize the NRA today, and perhaps rightfully so, but the NRA is actually a small part, you would argue.
Well, I just think that we villainize them as a very powerful lobby, which they are, but we're not looking at what they're representing. They represent, of course, gun owners in this country, but they also represent the firearms manufacturers around the world, because the American civilian market is the single biggest gun market in the world. And as gun controls have become tighter everywhere else in the world, this civilian market has become increasingly important to firearms manufacturers. So they put a lot more pressure on keeping this market open through the NRA. So the NRA is part of the problem. It is a problem because of these other interests, and governments have an interest in supporting firearms industries doing this through the NRA because they all want the world's firearms industries to be really healthy so that when they need arms in case of war or something like that, those industries will be there and
ready
and
to
functioning.
Go.
And, yeah.
And functioning already. They don't have to start
at full tilt.
Necessarily
yeah.
from scratch. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's dive in to the history now.
Okay.
And now we're going to go to Great Britain. And you focus on a particular period of time, about 125 years or so, and that's between 1688 and 1850. What's significant about those years?
1688 to 1815.
15 days?
Yeah. Yeah. There's the 1688 to 1815, you can think of as sort of the long 18th century, when and that's the time in which the Industrial Revolution occurred. I mean, people debate exactly when it occurred within that period, but there's general agreement that it did occur sometime in that window. And secondly, so that's the big economic narrative of the time. That's also the period in which you can identify a certain set of consistent political problems that are shaping what's going on in Britain. And one is, there's this revolution in 1688-89 called the Glorious Revolution, which establishes a constitutional monarchy in England. And defending that settlement is like the main political agenda
in Britain. Towards democracy.
To the extent that it establishes that Parliament is the ultimate authority, but Parliament is still not a representative body at this point. It only represents the interests of a small elite. So it's not a democratic polity, but it's moving away from the kind of absolutist monarchy that is flourishing at this point in Europe, in the rest of Europe and other parts of the world. Because the British want to protect this settlement of 1689, that revolution and the creation of a constitutional monarchy, they have to push back against European powers that would like to see that undone, which is the Spanish and the French. And so in 1815, the French are finally defeated and that question is resolved. And from that point, that British-French rivalry is kind of settled. So that's the other reason why this is kind of a coherent period or a long 18th century.
A number of wars. You had the Nine Years'
yes.
War, the War of Spanish Succession, the Seven Years' War, the U.S., the American mm-hmm. Independence War, the French Revolution,
mm-hmm.
And then also the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah, and the War of the Austrian Succession is in there too, before mm-hmm. the Seven Years' War. Yeah, Britain is almost always at war during this long period.
So there's a demand for guns.
So there is a demand for guns that's always increasing, and the order of magnitude that British gun makers can produce increases dramatically from the beginning of the period to the end of this period. And that's what I'm trying to explain.
Yeah.
How does that happen? Because they're still doing it in an artisanal way. But at the beginning of the period, they can produce tens of thousands per year. And by 1815, they can produce millions. So is that Industrial Revolution? If it is, how did it happen? I mean, there's not a sudden introduction of tons and tons of machinery into the methods for producing guns. So can we still call this an Industrial Revolution? And what are the driving... I think we can. And then how do you explain how that happened, given that that it isn't about the introduction of a lot of machinery.
And just tell me a little more about the industrial, just for a basis here, the Industrial
yeah.
Revolution. Same time period that we're talking
mm-hmm.
here.
And yeah.
would you argue the Industrial Revolution doesn't happen without this mass production over the years of guns?
Yeah, I mean, I want to make an argument that the transformation in the British economy that you see in this period was related to the fact that Britain is almost continually at war in this period. I don't think that those are coincidental factors. I think that the one is related to the other. And it's something that people have resisted saying for a long time. Partly, I think, because it was in this period that we had the birth of modern liberal political economy. And this is when Adam Smith is writing and he's criticizing what's going on around him.
He's criticizing the wars.
He thinks that he's criticizing the. He's offering a theory of how economic progress should happen. And it should be a pacific affair. It shouldn't be based on war. War is a drain on the economy, according to that theory. And I think what we've done is taken that theory as a literal description of what was going on at the time, rather than see it as a work of persuasion that was, you know, responding to the reality that Adam Smith was seeing around him, which was, in fact, that war was really shaping the economy at that time.
Yeah, even if you think here about the United States, I mean, just off the top of my head, you know, you get the wars of the Spanish-American War of 1898, mm-hmm. and you get economic development out of that. World War One, then you get the booming 1920s, and of course you get a depression, but one major way we get out of the depression is through World War Two and on and on.
Yeah, and we accept that that war drove a lot of economic growth in the 20th century. We know about the military-industrial complex, and yet for some reason when we talk about the invention of industrialism and the first industrial revolution in 18th century Britain, there is this reluctance to have it be about war, because that would imply that we need war for economic development. And then if you have a country that's trying to develop today, what are you going to prescribe? Are you going to say you should just have some wars? That's definitely not the message of the book, because the mechanism by which war drives economic change in this book is through state purchasing. So you can always imagine non-military forms of state purchasing that could also have a stimulating effect on an economy. So it's not necessary that war be at the heart of it, of growth. But I think it's the fear of that takeaway that people hesitate to associate these parallel narratives of constant war and economic transformation in the 18th century.
Yeah, and that's interesting about Adam Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes considered the father of capitalism.
Yeah.
Most people don't, and he wrote a lot about ethics as well. Oftentimes we forget mm-hmm. about that. But I think a lot of people probably don't realize that Adam Smith was trying to figure out a way of growing the economy without war.
Yeah. He didn't like there were a lot of people criticizing what was called old corruption at the time, which was the fact that an elite set of people were government contractors and making a lot of money in what looked like, you know, increasingly sort of scandalous ways, profiting from war, essentially. And many people were critical of this. But I think we know about that critique, but we haven't sort of internalized what that means, which is that, in fact, government contracting really was a driving force in the economy at the time. And so how do we accommodate that in how we understand the birth of industrialism?
Tell me about the Galton family.
So the Galton family were a Quaker family based in Birmingham for most of the 18th century. They came originally from Bristol, which is the port city closest to Birmingham. And they were involved in gun making for decades and decades, even though they were Quakers. And no one in the Quaker church in Birmingham seems to have raised any kind of objection to that fact.
Which is odd because they're pacifist Quakers.
Exactly. The Quakers believe in the kind of main principle of the Quaker sect is belief in the unchristian nature of war. And yet no one in the church seems to have objected for many many years until suddenly they did. And to me, that was a really intriguing historical mystery. Why do they not object for so long, given what we know about Quakers? And then why do they suddenly object when they do? You know, why then? What changed at that point that suddenly made the Galton family business a problem?
And when we talk about the Galton family, we should probably talk about the main figure of mm-hmm. this, and that's Samuel Galton Jr.
Yes, there are three Samuel Galtons, and he's the middle one, uh-huh. the middle generation.
So tell me more about this dynamic about being Quakers and yet being, they're manufacturing guns.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're manufacturing guns, and I think in trying to understand why the Quaker Church did not object.
How big mm-hmm. is their gun company at this point?
They become the single biggest gun manufacturing firm in the country. So in the government records about firearm procurement, the government often refers to these firearms contractors as Galton and the gun makers, because they were the single most prominent among a group of important gun contractors for the state. So they were the biggest players.
Also a big player in the Quaker community, because they're helping, bankroll the whatever they're...
Oh, they're very prominent. Yes, they make contributions to the church. They're well-known and very well-respected Quaker citizens and eminent citizens of Birmingham. There's nothing scandalous about them or what they do until suddenly there is something scandalous about them in the 1790s. And so I was setting out to understand how that happened.
And you did a lot of archival work in Birmingham.
I did, yes. I looked at there are thousands of pieces of materials in the Galton Family Archive, which are in the Birmingham City Archives. And there are also records of other gun makers there as well. Birmingham was a big hub of gun making developed by the British government, specifically at the start of this period that we're talking about. I also looked at the government records to put those together with the Galton records, and then the records of what's known as the Worshipful Company of Gunmakers, the gun-making company that was based in London, that Birmingham was created to sort of rival initially. So, and then I also looked at some records in India, because the East India Company was also a big player in the story and sort of a partner in the state.
This is also a story of empire?
It is.
Colonialism, I imagine.
It is, because all these wars that the British are fighting, most of them are global wars, and many of the contests take place either in North America or in South Asia or in some other part of the world. So it is, these are wars to protect the settlement of 1689, but they are also wars of conquest all over the world. So, and there's an argument here that that industrialism was also driven then by imperial conquest.
So in going through the documents, what were you able to find about the Quakers and why? What was it, 1795 again?
When the scandal erupts.
Why, yeah.
Why then?
Were you able to figure that out?
I think I did, yes. So I think a couple of things happened. So one thing is, I think Quakers became much more conscious of a need to be ethically consistent on a national stage.
Were they being criticized?
Well, so what happens was that the abolitionist movement takes off. This is a movement to end the slave trade. And Quakers become very prominent in that movement. And it's a movement that takes off after the British lose the war against the American colonies in 1783. That's the only defeat they experience in the 18th century. And it gives them a great deal of pause and sort of it's an opportunity to say, okay, what are we doing wrong? Why is God punishing us? What is the moral liability for which we're being punished? Oh, maybe it's the slave trade. And so the abolitionist movement takes off. Quakers are really important in it. And they become much more conscious of the need for ethical consistency on a national stage, their collective reputation. So that's one issue. At the same time, though, guns start to look different at exactly that moment. So for most of the 18th century, up till the 1790s, guns are mainly used, you know, in their civilian uses at least, they're mainly used in crimes around property. They're not used in crimes of passion. They're not used really for homicide or things like that.
That's, because it would have been better just to use a different weapon.
Exactly. In the heat of the moment, you would use whatever is
nearest. And if you missed, I mean, just the effort you had to put into reload even.
Exactly, yeah. 18th century musket would be a very frustrating weapon to turn to when you're really mad. But then in the 1790s, things change, because the wars that start in the 1790s are on a scale unprecedented, right? And hundreds of thousands of Britons become soldiers. And there's a whole new level of exposure to and experience with firearms. And for the first time, you start to see new kinds of casual violence using guns that's unrelated to property. And guns start to look bad or scandalous in a new way. And so I think Quakers become more conscious of scandal, and guns start to look more scandalous at exactly the same moment in the 1790s. And that's why Galton's business becomes a problem then, in particular.
We are in conversation with Priya Setia. She is a professor at Stanford University. She is the author of several books. Her latest, which we are in conversation about, is called Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. So the church then confronts Samuel Galton Jr.?
Yeah.
About this?
They confront him, and it almost seems like they do it reluctantly, because the way the Quaker sect is organized is there's a kind of an annual, or there's a yearly meeting and quarterly meetings and monthly meetings, and it's geographical. So London is sort of the leader of the national kind of organization of churches. And from London, the pressure starts to come that, okay, we hear that there are people amongst us who are in violation of our commitment not to make arms or participate in war. And reluctantly, one gets the feeling the Birmingham meeting starts to take action and respond to those requests from London that everybody kind of fall into line on this point. And I think one of the reasons there's a reluctance is because the Galtons are so prominent and such important members of the church there, and also in Birmingham generally.
Otherwise good Quakers.
And they're otherwise good Quakers.
Take away the guns.
They're otherwise very active in all kinds of philanthropic work. They're, they're very, very, very well reputed. And they do all kinds of other things besides making guns. So there's a sense that that's not their only business, and they're important in so many other ways, too.
Quakers. Here in America, we'll think of the American Friends Service Committee, I think. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about Quakers for people who may not know a lot.
Okay, so they're a sect that are founded sort of in the crucible of the civil wars of the 17th century, when there are all these political battles around religion that are fought out as military contests.
The Reformation?
So this is after this, a century later. And so George Fox, you know, in prison, arrives at this understanding that what they're doing is unchristian. And his ideas start to spread amongst a lot of soldiers and ex-soldiers especially. And he also travels to North America and spreads this new faith that way as well. And so they develop as sort of a sect apart who refuse the militarization of these religio-political struggles that are taking place in England at the time. So they suffer many civil disabilities too, as all dissenting sects in Britain do until the early 19th century. So they're barred from public office and things like that. But because they are kind of a well connected network within themselves, many of them really prominent in particular trades and industries. They also have a lot of a lot of strength as a group. You know, they have a collective reputation for honesty, reliability, good credit, and that makes them attractive as people to do business with for other merchant communities and industrialists, but also for the government, too. They are also attracted to those qualities. And so what you see happening is that even though they are this sect suffering different kinds of discrimination, disabilities, and so on, they also become kind of entangled with they almost come to the center of the structures of power in 18th century Britain. They set up banks that become really important to the financing of war. You know, and this is one thing that Galton points out when everyone suddenly becomes upset with his business in the Quaker church. He says, well, okay, I'm making guns, but you have a bank that's involved that helps the government prosecute its wars. And, you know, you produce iron that I use in my guns. So how are you any different from me? So what he sees when he looks at his Quaker network is, you know, everyone implicated in some way. And how is he any worse than
anyone
else?
Even to the level you're paying taxes.
Everyone who's paying taxes, every time you buy a cup of beer, and a tax is automatically paid, then you're implicated.
And that's his response to the
that's
church.
His response.
Where we're all participating on mm-hmm. some level or not. You make that argument today.
Yes, I mean there's something to that. I think that we like to forget, because I think it does. Insofar as any protest we do is about preserving our own conscience, then the more we avoid acknowledging our collective complicity or systemic complicity, the better we feel. Insofar as that's the end of protest. But if our protest is really about achieving some kind of real change, we need to think more about entire systems. And I think we've kind of lost that ability since the end of the Cold War, if I can go out on a limb. Yeah.
Why? What was different before the Cold War?
Well, I think, I mean,
we all understood we were a part of it.
Well, I think they were just alternative. People were thinking in terms of alternative systems, right? There were theories of, there were other alternatives to capitalist industrial way of life. There were socialist alternatives, right? And there was, Henry David Thoreau and tax resistance as like something you could do to engage an entire system, right?
Henry David Thoreau would have agreed with Galton.
Yeah, he would have.
Right? That's why he went to jail.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we've sort of lost those kinds of alternatives and have just accepted the existing order as it is. And then we try and find the particular problems in it to fix, but the rest of the system will remain intact. And the question is, can you really do that? You know, if you think about it, the origins of our modern economic order depended on trade in drugs, slaves, and firearms, and all the kinds of things that we would think of as sort of bad commodities to trade in now, right? But those are part of the origins of the entire system. So one, you really have to wonder whether they're just exceptions to a generally good system, or whether, we should be thinking that, wait a minute, this whole system is exploitative in some way and depends on it. And it's inequitable in many different ways, and it depends on violence and all kinds of things that we wouldn't be at peace with.
Certainly we wouldn't get the same kind of development, at least different. I don't know, better or worse, but at least different type of development, I imagine. If you were to take out these other things, take out guns, take out slavery.
Yeah, and the question, can you? Would the system have even developed without those particular kinds of goods? I mean, the slave trade was so foundational to the entire creation of our global system. Would it have formed without that?
Right.
I don't think so.
That's a pretty profound question.
Yeah, I don't think so. What's the counterfactual?
You know,
I don't know if we would have a global system the way we do now if we hadn't had the slave trade. Almost all the commodities that became essential to global markets depended on slave labor of some kind.
And guns.
Guns were a very important currency. They opened up markets. They allowed the British to trade in markets that otherwise were not welcoming to them. They opened up places for settlers from Europe. I mean, they were really important to the creation of our global economic system.
So Samuel Galton Jr. goes back to the church and says, we're all implicated. Don't deny it. How did the church respond?
Yeah, they didn't buy it.
Yeah. And I don't think I would have either. I'd be like, yeah, I get it. I know what you're saying. I just paid some sales tax on my...
They didn't buy it. They said, well, obviously there's a huge difference in degree of implication. And Galton's answer to that was, if this is about principle, then degree doesn't matter, right? It should leave it up to your private judgment. It's for you to live with your conscience, because only you can judge it if it's just a matter of degree. But interestingly, so two things happened. One, the church didn't buy it, but he kind of ignored the excommunication. So they formally disown him,
but he
keeps going to church anyway. And eventually he sort of almost weasels his way back even into the church business that he's been barred from. So he gives donations to the expansion of the burial grounds, for instance, just a few years after this, even though I think technically he's not supposed to. And even though at that point he's really, really heavily involved in arms production for the Napoleonic Wars. And so they tolerate that, his presence and his contributions. So that's one thing that happened. And on the other hand, in with time, many later generations of Quakers who looked back on the defense that he wrote actually thought it was quite persuasive. So there's a kind of shifting opinion about it over time. And they looked back and thought, actually, this makes a lot of sense, that there are, our agency is limited. There are systemic constraints on how much you can actually distance yourself from producing things that will be used in war.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and there are people who do it, tax resistors, even today, but there is a steep price for doing it, unless you're willing to live a life like some are that can completely avoid it. But there's even consequences there, what people can do.
And you see today, I don't know if you saw the headlines lately about Project Maven and Google, the Google employees who are circulating a petition that Google must not work on this Defense Department initiative, which would use Google artificial intelligence products to enhance, possibly in enhancing our use of drones.
Yeah, like recognizing who people
exactly
are.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, though, that even if, let's say, they succeed in and they're expressing this as part of the commitment to the don't be evil slogan of Google. But let's say this particular petition succeeds within Google and they back out of Project Maven. Nevertheless, Google will still be competing for contracts for offering its cloud technology services to the Defense Department. I mean, in other so many other ways, it, like all the other big tech companies, will, you know, they do wind up serving our defense interests, which are often offensive interests. So it's really, really hard to completely disconnect from economic activity that's going to in some way wind up contributing to militaristic or military activity.
Hard not to do.
It's hard not to do that. Yeah, yeah, it's hard not to be evil. Even Stanford University, you know, we get Pentagon funding for different, you know, and efforts within the university. And it often comes with this. This happened a few years ago, too. And the way it was spun was that, you know, there would be civilian spinoffs from so much of this investment. So it's good for everybody, right?
Money talks.
Yeah.
from Galton to...
Yeah, to Google.
To Google. We are in conversation with Priya Setia. Priya Setia is a professor of history at Stanford University, author of the book Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. This debate, I guess we'll call it, between Samuel Galton Jr. and the Quaker Church, we also get a remnant of this debate that's still around today about guns, and that being what, the protection of home or the protection of property.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was one way that he would argue that guns are okay.
That's correct, yeah. That insofar as you're using them... So in the 18th century, they didn't have formal police in Britain. So how would you protect your property? You would have a gun by the bedside, and that was considered acceptable even for Quakers. Quakers start disapproving of that, even that use of guns at this moment in the 1790s and you know, through the next, I guess, 15 or 20 years. But up till that point, that was considered an acceptable and respectable, even, use of guns. Because what else could you do,
right?
You need to, they're an instrument of terror, and you want to terrorize people from violating your property. And the law did the same thing. It was designed to terrorize people so that they wouldn't commit infractions that would require really severe punishment. So yes, he did believe that was an appropriate use. And often when people were shot in the course of violating some property, courts would acquit you for shooting someone in the course of defending your property. So that was okay to do.
Part of our debate still today.
Yeah, so but the thing is, in the United States, for a very, very until 2008, most interpretations of the Second Amendment understood that it was really directed at ensuring the provision of military arms in it for national or public defense, and not about the individual right to an arm for personal self-defense. That changed only very recently.
The Heller decision, exactly. The Supreme Court decision.
Exactly. And in Britain, that use of arms really ended kind of at the end of the 18th century, because that's when you do get formal police services. And then it was understood that having your own gun in your house was sort of redundant, because there were courts and police to handle the protection of property for you. So there were very, very tight gun possession laws in Britain throughout the modern period.
Priya Setia, let's talk a little bit more, maybe in detail, about how the fortunes amassed from the early gun industry would end up getting into finance. Galton's guns would, and the money from the guns, would actually eventually form its own bank.
Yes.
I mean, literally, just they created his own.
Yes, yes. In 1804, in the midst of the Napoleonic Wars, when the family's wealth was really skyrocketing from all this gun manufacturing for the war, they opened a bank. And a few banks open up at that point in Birmingham for similar reasons, because there's enough wealth in enough families to do that. And they actually partner in forming this bank with a man called Joseph Gibbons. And Gibbons was one of the other members of the Quaker Church who was appointed to reclaim Galton and persuade him to leave his gun manufacturing business and get into something else. And clearly Gibbons didn't mind 2 years later, you know, just a few years later, partnering with Galton, knowing that all the wealth he was bringing to their partnership had come from gun manufacturing. And so they start this bank, and later on they do, Gibbons leaves and another partner comes in, and but the bank survives and does really well, and eventually it's folded into what becomes Midland Bank, which eventually then got folded into HSBC today.
One of the largest,
most important. Exactly. And the other big British banks today, Lloyd's and Barclays, are also, you know, old Quaker banks that originated in this period and that were, whose growth was also related to all this war-related finance and trade that was going on in this period.
Was Lloyd's and Barclays, was that from guns?
No, the Lloyd's and Barclays are intermarried with the Galtons, so they're, you know, their connections.
They're all Quakers.
They're all Quakers. But the Lloyds were iron dealers. And so they provided a lot of the iron that the Galtons used in their firearms. So they did not themselves make guns, but they're implicated in it. And they were also important. Both those banks were important in financing the government's wars in that period. So they were implicated that way as well.
It's awkward, because I almost want to, but I love Quakers.
I love Quakers too.
You know?
These are the good guys.
These are...
So
yeah,
then,
I mean,
then if these are the good guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are the bad guys then?
It's a very human story. That's the thing, is there aren't any villains, right? It's systemic. And you know, even Adam Smith said, when he was criticizing the relationship between the East India Company and the government, he said, anyone in this position would be behaving this way. The problem is the system, right? So we also need to, you know, go back to thinking in terms of systems and think about ways to change systems rather than just leave everything intact and eliminate the one little bad detail as if the rest is not scandalous.
Right. Who was J.A. Hobson?
Hobson was a critic of... So he's a political economist and a liberal and a critic of a
lot.
Does
liberal mean then what it does now?
No, it doesn't. And it's interesting too, because his ideas become so important to Lenin, who's obviously a Leninist.
Influential to Lenin.
Yeah. So he comes up with a systematic, you know, critique of the economy that he saw around him 100 years after this Galton story unfolded. And what he saw then at the turn of the 20th century was that another version of corruption, that basically there are certain narrow sectional interests in the British economy, like the financial establishment and certain industries, that basically co-opt the government to fulfill their particular interests, and they drive foreign policy for the government, and the government is just serving those sectional interests to the cost of everybody else, and that everybody else become sort of duped by this jingoistic propaganda that these narrow interests spread around the country. And that imperialism and the expansion of empire are basically being driven by these narrow sectional interests. And this is an idea that Lenin later picks up. And in some ways, you know, that you can trace the connection between what he's saying and what Galton said 100 years before, except that what Hobson is saying is that only certain narrow sections of the economy benefit from this, not everyone else. And I think Galton would have said, look, we're all benefiting from this in some way. And I wonder, it's hard to say, maybe Hobson was more right in his time because there's more concentration of certain industries at that time than in Galton's time. But, you know, maybe there were other ways in which the general population was also profiting in ways that Hobson didn't realize.
Did Galton ever get out of the gun business?
So
did he ever have a reflection on this later on?
Not so. The Galton Jr. who wrote The Defense. So the whole family gets out of the gets out of the gun business in 1815 when the wars against France end, and I think that's because suddenly government orders kind of stop, and they also no longer have the outlet of the slave trade, because the slave trade has been abolished in 1807. And so it's not the most thriving industry to be in 1815, and they have this bank instead. So they pull out of it at that point.
Go into finance?
And they're in banking, and they have all kinds of other investments and interests. They're just so wealthy also at that point that they don't need to actively pursue an industrial business anymore at that point. And so the Galton who wrote The Defense, he dies in 1832. But his son, who's called Samuel Tertius Galton, just stops doing any kind of business and just lives off the wealth that's been accumulated, in his later years. And his son is Francis Galton, who is the father of eugenics, who is a, you know, kind of a gentleman of leisure at that point. I mean, there's so much.
A Quaker?
No, he's no longer. The family ceased being Quakers when Samuel Tertius Galton marries outside the fold. He marries Violetta Darwin. Charles Darwin is his nephew, I guess, through her. So Francis Galton and Charles Darwin were cousins. Yeah, so they're really, you know, the Quakers have, you know, this endogamous tradition. And once they break out of that, Tertius Galton breaks out of that. But they marry into some of these really prominent families within Britain and become part of the mainstream of kind of British intellectual and political establishments of the 19th century.
What is the role of the state in all this?
So what I found was that, you know, when I say that war drove a lot of industrial activity, what I'm saying is that state offices, like the Ordnance Department that had the job of procuring war material, that they are doing things in what we would look back and call the private sector. And they were doing things there to make it possible for British gun makers to produce orders of magnitude more with each successive war. So they were changing the organization of the industry. They were playing with, you know, they were creating things that we would call factories, looking back, sort of trying to create efficiencies in the system so that they could get greater and greater output. They were playing with the design of the gun in order to arrive at something that would be maximally mass producible. So you see government offices really heavily involved in the design of the commodity itself and in the industrial organization of its production in a way that I think historians haven't really recognized, you know, that the state had such an important role in driving industrialism and the expansion of industrial capacity so that it could produce on a mass scale, the mass scale that we think of when we think of industrial revolution.
Priya Sethi, earlier book, Spies in Arabia. Mm-hmm. This is about the Middle East, World War I period.
Yes.
Connection between that
Yeah, this. There is a connection. That first book, which came out in 2008, was also about military technology. It was about the British invention of aerial policing in the Middle East in the period around World War One. So when I set out to write a second book, it was again going to be about military technology, but I wanted to look at trade in weaponry. And so I had intended to write a book on arms trading in the modern period generally. But when I started to look for the beginning of that story, and I stumbled on this archive of the Galton family, and I felt like, wait a minute, there's a story here that challenges our received wisdom about the Industrial Revolution, and it needed a book of its own. I just kind of hunkered down and decided to write a book on the 18th century and the Industrial Revolution. And so this book does go up through, you know, quick and dirty through the 20th century at the end, but it's much more anchored in the 18th century than I had originally imagined it would be.
Where do you go through in the 20th century?
Well, I do try and bring things up to the present so that we can connect the dots between, you know, how the dynamics that govern the trade in small arms from 1815 to the present, and also the dynamics of how we criticize that and how we continue to echo, you know, the Quaker critique of Galton, and how much we continue to do that when we focus on the villainy of, you know, say the NRA, rather than looking at wider systemic complicity.
Why these issues? Well, what spurred you? Because you told me before we began, took you about 10 years, maybe a little longer, to write this book, do the research, everything that you had to do. Wasn't particularly on what your doctoral thesis was on.
Well, I think, you know, there is that continued interest in military technology, and I've always been interested in power and the exercise of power and the tools that are used to exercise power that made imperialism possible in ways that maybe it would not otherwise have been. Like, the British needed technology in order to do what they did in the Middle East, and so on. And so that's always been sort of an abiding interest. But there was also a personal story, and the gun control debate was on at the time, you know, when I started this book in 2007. But I think also there was a shooting incident within my family, and I opened the book with that story. And I think, you know, those are the sort of intimate or personal stories that make a more general history personally relevant. I mean, and the reason why the history of guns is a big history is because I think most people have some first or second or third degree kind of interaction with guns, where something has happened, and we all live this the reality of gun violence. And so it touched my family too. And working through, you know, this figuring out the place, why guns are so pervasive in our world, how they became so pervasive, how they continue to be unregulated when we regulate the sale of every other kind of weapon. I mean, that was a way for me to come to terms with, you know, why this incident happened in my family. You know, just how did the gun get into the hand of, you know, my uncle, you know, when this incident happened.
Can you tell me more about that incident?
Yeah.
I'd be remiss at this point.
Yeah, no, it was an incident over property. And this was in Punjab, which is where my family is from. Let me just give me a second. So my family's from a small place in Indian Punjab, and there was a dispute over property between my uncle and his uncle. So my uncle and my grandfather's younger brother. And it was just, and there was this backdrop of violence within the state of Punjab. There was a secessionist movement at that time. And I do think there's a relationship between civilian violence and, you know, military violence as well. But in any case, finally, this kind of constant conflict between these two branches of the family got to a point where my uncle shot at his uncle, and you know, all kinds of things went wrong and went downhill from that point. And it was just a very, very sad and painful event in the family, and I could see the effect on my dad, and it bothered me. And because we had the memories of that place were so wonderful, and it was such a big family. And just seeing the kind of destruction of that and over property. And I think writing the book did help me understand, you know, why guns are, why we turn toward guns in disputes over property. Because it's a way of committing violence in a way that feels impersonal at times, I think. And I think what my uncle was doing was trying to make his uncle feel like a stranger who's trespassing on his property and kind of denying the real, you know, loving emotional bond that existed between them. And so, yeah, so in a way, the writing the book helped me. I didn't expect going in that I would find this when I looked at data about untimely death in Britain, that all of the gun deaths would be about property. So that was a surprise to really find that. But I did find that. And so it was really helpful to understand that and to understand why guns are so important in Punjabi culture also, which they are. And I think that's partly a legacy of British Empire there, and the idea of martial races in Punjab, and how the spread of guns in that culture.
Yeah, you think that's true of all former colonial places?
No, I think, you know, in India, generally, the gun control laws are really tight, and that's a colonial legacy. The British didn't want Indians to have guns. But Punjabis, there's something about guns in Punjab, and I think that part of it comes from an idea. I mean, after there was this big mutiny, big rebellion in India against British rule in 1857-58. And after putting down that rebellion, the British decided that they were going to trust Punjabis, especially as soldiers in the British Indian Army. So heavy recruitment from Punjab began at that point. And there was this whole race theory associated with it, which is that these are martial people who have a particular kind of masculinity, and that just guns are appropriate there in a way that they wouldn't be in Bengal or some other place in India. And so I think Punjabis at some point start to buy in to that identity too. And there's a lot of smuggling of guns into India because there are tight gun controls. When Indians want guns, they come through the northwest frontier, which is present-day Afghanistan, through Punjab into the rest of India. They're coming there from the Persian Gulf. They're coming from Oman. And the British really, really struggle in the early 20th century and that entire period before they lose India and Pakistan to control that flow of arms into Afghanistan and present-day Punjab. So I think the presence of guns there and the affection for guns there and the reliance on guns there is a cultural legacy, partly of you know, 200 years of British rule.
Priya Setia, that was very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. That was fun.
It was fascinating. Priya Setia has been our guest. Again, she is a professor of history at Stanford University, and she is the author of the book Empire of Guns: The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
wanna smash, crash, blast, smash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, let's pump their rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want, we want, we want. We wanna liberate and land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we feature for the hour independent journalist Peter Byrne. In a series of articles over the past year, Peter Byrne has been looking at extremism. In one article from The New Scientist magazine, he asks about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. In another piece Peter Byrne published, on the origins of white nationalism. An hour with Peter Byrne on the Project Censored Show today. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we talk with independent journalist Peter Byrne. He's a Northern California-based award-winning investigative journalist and has an uncanny ability to mine reportable nuggets of graft and corruption out of mountains of government and corporate records. Peter Byrne's recent pieces included Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, also Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. Peter Byrne has won many awards over the years for his fantastic reporting, including one a few years ago from Project Censored. On today's program, we're going to talk about the anatomy of terror, what makes normal people become extremists. That will be the foreign element of our conversation, but we'll also bring it domestic by talking about the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, Mickey.
So, Peter Byrne, you've, as usual, been very busy writing about fascinating things, and today we're going to focus on a couple of articles that you did, one from summer of 2017 and another very recent, both in The New Scientist or newscientist.com. The one from August 2017, you know, you've been writing about this topic for a while. This is called Anatomy of Terror or Roots of Terror, as it is in the print edition. What makes normal people become extremists? And then the tagline for this, to give listeners an idea where you're going, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives, but recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. What brought you into writing about this specific topic? And again, you have a background, too, as a science writer.
I was reading the New York Times, of all things, which I never subscribed to. I always use Tor so I can get it for free. And it was reporting on ISIS in Iraq and Syria. This is about 2.5, 3 years ago. And I noticed that the territory that ISIS was controlling tended to flow along the Tigris and Euphrates River and major roadways, which reminded me of a network. And in network science, you talk about how certain nodes are more powerfully connected than other nodes, for example, and they're connected by edges, which in this case would be the rivers and the roads. And I was thinking, well, since ISIS is obviously such a bunch of bad guys, why aren't we like cutting these edges and isolating them? And I didn't know the answer. So I remembered after 9/11, I had interviewed this man at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey about terrorist networks, a man named John Arquilla. And he had now risen up to be the chair of the Department of Defense Analyses, a really connected dude in the Pentagon and all that kind of stuff. So I went down to Monterey and spent a couple of days there talking to these people that teach special operations, people like SEALs and Rangers and Green Berets, how to hunt terrorists. And it turns out that they use complex adaptive systems theory to try and figure out what to do, which is basically, people maybe used to know it as chaos theory. It's the attempt to kind of find patterns in any kind of turbulent data stream so that you can make some kinds of predictions on it. And what these guys who were really embedded inside the military, academic, industrial science complex, war of terror complex, were telling me was we totally messed up. The war on terror is an awful mistake. We shouldn't even be attacking ISIS. We should not be bombing Mosul. It's going to all turn bad. And they, of course, turned out to be correct. I mean, Mosul is completely destroyed. So I started looking at it from a science point of view, and what I discovered was that there's a whole range of sciences, from neurobiology and epidemiology and psychology and linguistics and physics and chemistry. Literally, almost every science you can think of, there's terrorism focus somewhere in academia or in the private sector or in military-type organizations. And you don't read about this in the New York Times or anywhere, but inside this huge terrorism studies industry, which has just exponentially grown after 9/11, there's literally billions of dollars funneled into studying terrorism one way or another. You've got two kinds of focuses. You've got a kind of a linear focus, which is like, they're bad people, we should just go kill them, which reverberates back to creating more terrorists, of course, which is provable.
ISIS was not in Iraq prior to the invasion in 2003.
ISIS is a direct result of the destruction of the Iraqi socioeconomic infrastructure.
So this approach is create bad guys, get the bad guys, create more bad guys, and keep throwing money
and spends a lot of money. Like right now, Brown University's study shows that upwards of $6 trillion, which is bigger than the gross national product of the United States, has been spent on this war on terror, which is the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and all the counterterrorism so-called efforts that go with it, including drone strikes, and paying scientists and others to study the phenomena. So what happened to me was I began to see that there was all this scientific analytics around this. There wasn't much data, because most of the data that is used for these studies, remarkably, tends to be drawn from English-only media sources. It turns out that most of the data, you know, you would think that we have this vast NSA satellite, you know, spying infrastructure, which we do, of course, but what that infrastructure is focused on is trying to find, quote-unquote, bad guys and kill them. There's no focus whatsoever inside that apparatus on looking at the root causes of what we call terrorism, which is actually really a tactic used by insurgencies. There's no such thing as a terrorist. There's no such thing as a terrorist philosophy. It's not a strategy. It's a tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting foreign invasions and the repression of local civil rights.
That's a pretty significant definition that you're giving us here.
There are officially almost 150 definitions of terrorism in the academic lexicon, as it were, all of them pretty much invented by institutions that are devoted to fighting terrorism. My own personal definition is that it is violence directed against civilians for political purposes, which includes, of course, states. But probably 99.9% of the definitions in use deliberately exclude states and focus only on what they call non-state terrorism, as if it's a thing, when it's actually just an expedient tactic that is used from time to time by people that are generally fighting to redress what they perceive to be grievances, you know, and generally those grievances are real, even though in the academic lexicon they always qualify it by saying perceived grievance. Because, you know, nobody really wants to solve this issue of the exponential growth of terrorism since 9/11. So back to the database situation, you've got all these people who are analyzing incident rate data, numbers of attacks based on English-only media reports. They don't check out the Russian media or the Arab press or anything that's not in English. And they build these databases and they confuse insurgent actions with terrorist-type attacks. And they have no database for counterterrorism. There is no database about the numbers of terroristic attacks on civilian populations mounted by the United States and its so-called coalition in Iraq and Afghanistan, Somalia, and about 60 countries around the world where we have special operations forces now working.
In fact, you quote Martha Crenshaw in your article, Roots of Terror. Crenshaw says, we don't even know what success might look like in this war on terror. And she likens it to a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah, she says they pop up, we hit them on the head, and then we wait for the next one to pop up. But what I found was I talked to people like Wayne Porter, who used to be the chief of naval intelligence for the Middle East and then was the science advisor to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who's really into complexity theory type analyses. And he was saying that if we don't address the root causes of terrorism, we're going to end up not only bankrupting the United States economy, but we're going to annihilate our democratic values, such as they are. And I was being told time and time again that the official line that ISIS is evil and we must root them out is 180 degrees wrong, that actually we'd be much better off, and this was actually, I think, proven by what happened in Mosul and Raqqa, leaving a group like ISIS to evolve on its own. These horrible beheading public relations stunts that they pulled, evil as they are, were not their mode of operation. Public opinion polls actually showed that before and after ISIS was in charge of Mosul, they were popular in large segments of the population. In fact, they didn't seize Mosul in a day. It was over years. They built up a kind of presence, and then one day the Iraqi army ran away and they took over. So at any rate, as a journalist, I decided that if I was going to write about this, I needed to go talk to some people that were in the field and ask my new friends in the military how I could get to Mosul. The military itself was not allowing reporters to embed anymore. Not that I wanted to embed, but I wanted to not get killed either. And I figured walking around Mosul without an armed guard handy was probably like suicide, and I'm not into that. But what I did do was I found a young behavioral economist out of Harvard named Vera Mironova, who happens to be a Russian-American, and she was embedded with Iraqi special forces in Mosul, the so-called Golden Division, which was leading the fight against ISIS in Mosul. So I went to northern Iraq, to Kurdistan. I flew into Erbil and met up with Vera, and we drove to Mosul in January 2017 through numerous checkpoints, which she just flashed some pieces of paper she had from the Iraqi military, and they let her through. And we ended up arriving in Mosul right as the prime minister of Iraq was declaring that eastern Mosul was liberated from ISIS, east of the Tigris River, as it were. The west was the old city, which took another year for ISIS to be driven out of, mostly by pulverizing the city and tens of thousands of civilians that lived there. So I hung out with Vera and these Iraqi soldiers in their Humvee and with their guns, and most of them didn't speak English. So I had my smartphone, so-called, and used Google Translate, and we had some pretty hilarious conversations. And we had some pretty hilarious meals. At one point, they asked me if I would like to have pacha for breakfast. And we went to this restaurant in Mosul, which was about the only one open at that point. And they all ordered pizzas, and they ordered me a pacha, which happens to have been sheep brains and intestines stuffed with God knows what. And it was a very unappetizing, although probably a McDonald's would be equally unappetizing to an Iraqi point of view. And I ate it, and all these guys were staring at me, and they were kind of disappointed. They said, oh, you must be special forces. It actually wasn't that bad. It was kind of tasty. The intestines were actually stuffed with rice. So about 2 days later, that suicide bomber went in there and blew up the whole restaurant. But hanging out with Vera, we would go into ISIS houses that had been recently abandoned, or the ISIS cadre were either dead or captured. And the soldiers would look for intelligence material, you know, phone numbers, things like that, because they want to be able to track more people down and kill them. Vera was looking for anthropological stuff. You know, we were gathering up food wrappers. Turns out that ISIS likes Johnny Walker Red a whole lot, and they smoke Marlboros. And we also found diaries that Russian women who had married ISIS fighters had kept that were actually quite moving. And one of them in particular, this woman had written a letter to her husband who was in the ISIS front line talking about how they were going to meet in heaven after they were martyred. And then she scrawled the recipe of a type of cake that can only be made with a special kind of milk that you can get in Russia, and was hoping that she could find some in embattled Mosul. You know, so terrorist dream of comfort food too, as turns out. At any rate, all sorts of interesting anthropological stuff was gathered. And after that, I left and got back into the United States just in time to see all the demonstrators at San Francisco International Airport protesting Trump telling the Iraqis that they could no longer come here, and, you know, the Muslim countries were banned from America and stuff like that. Actually, that started when I was in the refugee camps interviewing people outside of Mosul, and they were really, like, horrified that we would destroy their country and then tell them they couldn't come here to escape.
And there'd already been 5+ million refugees coming out of Iraq.
Yeah, and it was like close to a million coming out of the Mosul area. They're still living in these horrible refugee camps, partially run by the UN, partially run by the family that owns Kurdistan. And a lot of them can't go back to Mosul. One family that I interviewed in particular, ISIS had come to their house and they said, we're going to live in your house. You can live on the top floor. We're going to live in the bottom floor. And the guy was a welder. You have to weld stuff for us, like prison bars and things like that. Metal plate for suicide vehicles. And the guy did. He had three young kids, right? Which didn't mean that he was ideologically in tune with them. But during the battle, he managed to escape and they ended up in this camp. To my knowledge, he's still there. But they can't go back. Because his neighbors think that he's an ISIS person, and when people think you're an ISIS person in those types of circumstances, generally some kind of vigilante terrorism is executed upon you. So I wrote this article, The Roots of Terror, The Anatomy of Terror, for New Scientist. New Scientist actually sent me to Mosul to do this. They're a wonderful organization based in the United Kingdom, and they have an American staff as well.
Paying you to do actual investigative journalism on the ground where there are no other reporters.
No. Actually, no, there were corporate media. I ran into some New York Times photographers and people like that. They tended to be freelancers and stringers. There was some people from the mainstream media that were doing some pretty good stuff. In fact, I had my little video camera with me, and I sold a bunch of clips to Fox News, of all people.
No, I remember that Fox News was one of the places that had published something. Others didn't bite.
It's funny because Herb Beale is actually full of all sorts of freelance journalists, and the trick is to get to the front line. So I happened to be in a great position because Vera was so thoroughly embedded and had all these documents so we could get through all these checkpoints. But a lot of reporters, are little freelancers that were selling their wares for pittances to, CNN or whatever, were just flocking around dead bodies trying to get the same story, But nobody at all was looking at the context and at the roots of terror. As far as I know, if you look at stuff that was coming out in the New York Times or the New Yorker, they love to talk about ISIS people throwing gay guys off of towers and head chopping and evil this and evil that. But nobody talks about why they're doing it. The New Yorker had this like 20-page article on atrocities, but no context whatsoever. So that's my goal, is to provide context. And in this particular case, you provide context by gathering data that actually is true, and then you analyze it, and you can use science to analyze it.
We're speaking with investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article that was published last year in New Scientist. It's at newscientist.com. The article is called Roots of Terror, and we will continue that conversation with Peter Byrne after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. We're joined today by award-winning investigative journalist Peter Byrne. We're talking about an article he did last year called Roots of Terror. In a little while, we're going to talk about a more recent article that you did and sort of connect things abroad with some of the things maybe happening here domestically. But let's cut to the chase here, literally. What are the roots of the terror that you saw when you were there? So what is it that the corporate media were missing?
I talked to any number of people in Erbil, which is a sister city to Mosul, which was not captured by ISIS. And they would tell me, we were happier under Saddam Hussein. You came in and you completely destroyed our country and turned it into a wasteland, and our economy is tanked, and we can't even sell oil anymore because your companies came in there and took all these production sharing contracts, which were unfair. So the roots are socioeconomic. The military types that actually do look at root causes will tell you time and time again that the major cause is people fighting insurgencies against a foreign invasion and people reacting to the repression of civil rights at a local level. It's local, local, local. So when the United States went in there and installed a Shiite government to take over from the previous Sunni-oriented regime of Saddam Hussein, the Shiites started to exterminate Sunnis. And to make a long story short, they fought back. And ISIS gradually emerged from that. and completely liquidated the idea of national boundaries that had been instituted after World War I by the Sykes-Picot Agreement and moved into Syria, you know, saying that we're having a caliphate. We're not going to abide by these kind of imperialist mandated boundaries anymore. And that excited a lot of people, not just in the region, but obviously in Europe and even in America, where something upwards of 40,000 foreign fighters came there. A lot of the foreign fighters were ideologically driven. I think that a lot of the people in Iraq and Syria that ended up joining not just ISIS, but al-Nusra and a bunch of other insurgent groups with Islamist bent were more looking to have regular incomes, even if it was loot. And to escape enemies, you know, and if you're a Sunni and you're being pursued by the Shia, you want to join a gang, right? There's another element, too. I mean, Martha Crenshaw, who I talked to, is kind of the first person to really study terrorism starting back in the 70s from a scientific point of view. And she's famous for saying that terrorists are rational actors, which was a break with the previous conception, which was that all terrorists are psychopaths.
Yeah, crazy people.
She was saying that they actually have valid socioeconomic grievances, even if you don't agree with their methods of addressing them, which, you know, it's pretty hard to agree with somebody blowing up a bunch of school kids. But the United States does that with bombs all the time anyway, right? So what's the difference? Actually, I found something that went beyond Crenshaw's analysis, which is it was good at the time. But the more that the phenomena is studied, the more we see from a psychological point of view that even though the organizations themselves might be rational actors, they might be launching terrorist attacks against point X or point Y or this mosque or that army unit or that police station for tactical purposes in an insurgency, and that's rational kind of military thinking, that people that actually blow themselves up or that go and mass murder, you know, people with bombs and automatic weapons or even trucks are not like really normal. Give me a break. Killing people isn't like really the same thing to do, you know, right. Whether you're a terrorist or a counterterrorist or a Navy SEAL or an ISIS member, you know. So I began to think, you know, what is it really going on here psychologically? Now, the thing with the Islamist variety of insurgent slash terrorists is that the kind of interviews that have been done with them generally have been after they've been captured, which they have very often a political point of view that they want to put across. They're not exactly going to tell you the truth. There's some cultural prohibitions against asking them about their childhoods and things like that. But as I was told by some very astute British researchers, the more that you talk to people that have blown up civilians, the more you find that they did it because they were really distressed that their own family had been blown up by the Americans or by the Shia. Now, is that a rational thing to do? Your family is blow up, so you go blow up somebody else's family? You know, not necessarily. So what makes a quote-unquote terrorist tick is the question. And here's the thing. You can strive to make a profile of a typical terrorist, so-called, but you can't. And people have been trying to do that for decades now, and they can't. Because all of the various qualities that you might say would drive a terrorist, socioeconomic grievances, perhaps not mental illness, but some kind of mental distress because of childhood sexual abuse or whatever, a lot of people that have those particular configurations don't commit terrorist acts. So why does a person that has the same kinds of characteristics that millions of other people have commit a terrorist act? It's all about context. They do it in a certain environment. There's a confluence of socioeconomic environmental conditions with a personality that is predisposed in some way because of what's happened in their life, and it has happened politically around them to respond by killing innocent people.
So, Peter Byrne, another element here of this in terms of the way that the United States and other states have been dealing with terrorism, you know, we mentioned the whack-a-mole quote earlier. We mentioned the idea of creating terrorists and killing terrorists. But one of the offshoots of this, too, is to purportedly disrupt the networks, disrupt the terrorist networks. And one of the ways that we've seen that going on is by trying to shut down parts of the Internet or censorship or combat misuse of the Internet in ways that proliferate extremism. So that's that language, extremism, has been used. And here, Cass Sunstein in the United States under Obama, you know, looked into that. There are many other groups in the U.S. that are looking into this extremist rhetoric, and they're trying to close down sectors of the Internet. So what can you say about this?
Well, they're never really going to close it down because the Internet is like the primary lens by which the intelligence agencies find people to target with stings and make a big PR stink about. They've stopped terrorists in their tracks when generally they've approached people that otherwise wouldn't have done anything and given them the opportunity to sound off, and then arrested them for basically not actually doing anything. On the other hand, there's a ton of data showing that most people are driven to join groups that engage in terrorism by friends and family. It's a camaraderie thing. You join a group that's engaged in violent extremism of various sorts, generally in the beginning, for safety or for companionship in a stressed out situation, which you might find in Iraq. Which brings us to the question of white nationalism.
There's another article that we want to get to here. So you just brought up white nationalism. This other article you did, Roots of Terror, was published last year. And now just in June 2018, you have another article here that's at newscientist.com on the origins of white nationalism. What motivates far-right extremism? Sociological studies are giving new insights and ways to tackle the phenomenon. And Peter Byrne, you then go and write about this. So coming from your experience in Iraq, how did that inform you, or did it at all, in terms of what you found here in particular extremist movements in the U.S.?
Well, what I was interested in was the psychology of people that are driven by socioeconomic and political circumstances to engage in, you know, violent extremism against otherwise innocent people, you know, civilians. And most of the jihadist types that are interviewed about those types of issues are in prison, and their interviews are biased in that regard, and you don't really, because of cultural phenomena, get into questions of, say, sexual childhood abuse and substance abuse and things like that. So I convinced New Scientist to send me to Orange County to interview former terrorists, Los Angeles Hammerskin types, Christian Identity people, people that in the 90s and the early aughts had actually engaged in viciously beating and sometimes murdering black people and Latinos and Mexicans and gay people. And in the epicenter of neo-Nazism and white supremacy that emerged in Orange County in the 70s as the previously purely pristine white suburbs were infiltrated by blacks and Asians. And I hooked up with a scientist at Chapman University named Pete Simme, who has probably done the most comprehensive analytics on the origins of white nationalist, neo-Nazi, violent extremism of anybody. He actually wrote a book called American Swastika that came out a couple years ago, based on his embedding with a bunch of neo-Nazis in Orange County and elsewhere, to the extent that he would go to their parties celebrating Adolf Hitler, and he'd be in their houses when they had, for Christmas, they would have a swastika on the Christmas tree instead of a star. Their kids would have, like, coloring books, black people being lynched. They would look like otherwise normal suburban families, but they had this kind of culture going on, this safe space. And he also interviewed in a very scientific way, took the life histories of several hundred former white supremacist neo-Nazi types that had abjured their former violent ways, as well as people that were also active. And what he found was that probably 80% of the people he interviewed had sexual abuse and physical abuse growing up as children. They came from broken homes. They came from parents that had substance abuse problems. They themselves had substance abuse problems. So by the time they were in their teens, which is generally when people join up with skinheads and neo-Nazi type groups, they were already predisposed to act out their psychological predilections violently. And they would hook up with groups that gave them a sense of comradeship, and that also provided safety, because when you're living on the streets and you're going around randomly kicking people and worse, they join a skinhead group, for example, and then they become ideologically inculcated with the tenets of white supremacy. And time again, people who have studied white supremacists and neo-Nazi types in the United States are finding the same thing, that these are psychologically really damaged people. They're not necessarily psychotic. They're not like narcissists like, say, our president or Ted Bundy types. But they're people that have some serious issues, you know, personality disorders, that tend to flock together in these groups and then act out these problems that they had generally stemming from their childhood.
You talk in the article, too, about sociological research on extremists, and you mentioned that it's kind of difficult
to really study what goes on in some of these groups. What do you do? Do you put out an ad and say, hey, we want to talk to some Nazis? Or
no, it's the kind of what they call a snowball effect. Mm-hmm. You find one person and they lead you to a series of other people, which is, from a scientific point of view, it's a little bit problematic because mm-hmm. you're supposed to have a randomized study and it's not random.
It's not random at all, actually. Yeah, right. But this is how you're getting insights from people that are part of this.
It's the only way to do it. You know, you can't advertise right. for violent extremists, Nazi lovers, and they're not going to flock around. So you also have to get permissions from your institutional review boards right. and your universities, which means that you're not going to cause harm to your subjects that you're interviewing. And Vera in Iraq had that in Premature, mm-hmm. and Pete Simi in Southern California also had that approval, and he didn't. A lot of it's anonymized, and the data is not used for, you know, intelligence or law enforcement purposes. It's used purely to find out what makes people tick.
And so in your estimation, you know, again, you wrote about the Charlottesville 2017 events and a whole slew of people that were talked to. What did you come away with, or what do you see any similarities, differences between what you were seeing when you were looking at people in ISIS?
There's a lot of similarities. I look at it as two kinds of spectrums. If you have a spectrum of, say, psychosis to normality. So if you have a spectrum of mental health, and then you have a spectrum of grievances, from the grievances of, say, a white supremacist who thinks that knocking down Confederate monuments is a Jewish plot, to the grievance of, say, somebody in Iraq whose family was bombed by the United States and whose business was destroyed by the opposite religious ideology, you know, that's a real grievance. So you've got a not very real grievance, and you've got a real grievance. And then you've got not too crazy, and then you've got really crazy. I think it's kind of an inverse relationship. The more crazy you are, the more likely you are to believe a not really true grievance. The less crazy that you are, the more logical and rational you are. You're going to believe one that's really true, like I'm being bombed and my entire country's being destroyed. How can I fight back?
Empirical evidence.
And terrorism is a weapon of people that don't have F-16s and atom bombs and things like
Powerless,
that. Because it's
right.
a political thing. You want to terrorize your enemies so that they stop terrorizing you. And interesting, what was found out in the Twitter stream around 2014 in the territory that ISIS seized in Iraq and Syria was that before the United States started bombing ISIS in 2014, the Twitter enemy was identified as the near enemy. It was the imam down the road, or the shopkeeper that was not bowing to Mecca often enough. But the minute that the bomb started to drop, the far enemy came into play, and that was the chatter about bombing people in Paris and in the United States mm-hmm. and Brussels and things like that. So the exporting of ISIS terror to the West was a direct result, data-driven and provable result of the United States bombing Mosul and Raqqa and the Syria.
So coming back here to the United States then, and on your studying of the white nationalist movements, and the state that that's in now, and again, it seems as if in the Trump presidency that, you know, sort of the mask has kind of come off of this, and we've seen more of this. Again, this is not new in our history per se, but we've certainly seen more visibly white nationalist movements, these kind of movements that are very intolerant. What is your idea, based on your research, how do you tackle that phenomenon? How do you get to the roots of this?
I think it's actually easier than the other phenomena, the jihadist phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I will refer to the ethnographer and sociologist Catherine Blee at the University of Pittsburgh, who mm-hmm. I interviewed for this article in New Scientist about white nationalism. Blee actually has embedded with white nationalist neo-Nazi women over the decades. When we talked about the roots of white nationalism, she stated very clearly that it was racism in America. In our society, racism is embedded into the society. It's embedded into the culture. It's been here for hundreds of years. As the Trump phenomenon show, it didn't really go away after the civil rights movement. It was just waiting to pounce. And it's metastasizing now. So if you have in your culture a kind of racist status quo, even unconscious racism, if a bell curve of racism in America has a mean value, then on the tails of the curve, on the out, you're going to have outliers who are going to be violent, perhaps terroristic. So her suggestion is, if we want to get to the roots and solve the question of white nationalism and violent extremism, including Christian identity, anti-abortion clinic attacks and things like that, murders, then we have to adjust our thinking in our own culture. We have to actually develop and evolve a society and a culture in which racism is not acceptable. And then the outliers will gradually go away and should be treated as a criminal problem, which also, in my opinion, applies to the question of international jihadist terrorism. Mm-hmm. That is a criminal problem, not a problem that requires an entire Western society to mobilize a multi-trillion dollar war based on fear and the profits of Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, and would you argue that education is some way that it's possible to get? I mean, look, we've had education for ages. We've gradually, certainly in the last 50 years, had education about race, about structural racism, sexism. And in fact, we have whole movements basically come out of this to try to address, to do what you said, to try to, when people are committing crimes, they're committing crimes.
There's something else, Mickey, that ties it all together besides the psychological aspect. Now, this ties together white nationalism, neo-Nazi type thinking, Christian identity type thinking with Islamist jihadist types of movements. And that is neoliberal globalization. It's inequality driven. Poverty is well known not to be a driver of insurgency and terrorism. It's inequality and repression that are the drivers. So in the United States, there is a tremendous amount of economic and social inequality, and that is driving the racist movement. In the Middle East and Indonesia, where you have Islamist insurgent terrorist types of organizations and movements, it is also driven by the inequalities between the ruling elites and the masses of the people. Because people that engage in political terrorism and insurgency, they're not actually, from their own points of view, doing it because they just want to blow up people. They consider themselves to be altruists, and in many ways they are. They are speaking for masses of people through a lens that can only be appreciated if you're there on the ground. And I have to add that from white nationalist terrorist types of organizations to jihadist type terrorist organizations, none of them act without mass bases. They have to have mass bases. There are people, billions of people, that support these movements because they are the only political antidote to the depredations of neoliberal globalization, which is coming in extracting resources through military force and the brutality of capitalist exploitation.
And in these two articles, you're getting at this is something that is going on abroad, but it's also happening here, of course, domestically.
It's global. That's why they call it globalization. And, you know, globalization, you know, ever since the meltdown of 2008, it's gotten stronger and stronger and stronger with the gap between the haves and the have-nots, as we've seen in this country, which is basically run by Goldman Sachs, right? So it's not like totally out of line that your person on the streets who's got some issues is going to be attracted to the idea that Jews are running the world and that therefore we should kill them all, or that the blacks are trying to muddy up our otherwise pristine race. We saw this happen in Hitler's Germany. We're seeing it happen now in Eastern Europe, in Poland and elsewhere, in Germany itself and in England. You know, there's a tremendous resurgence of this weird mix of plutocracy and populism that Trump embodies, which the new leader of Italy embodies, where the immigrants that are being expelled as refugees from the war on terror's horrors in the Middle East are being turned away from Western countries and told to go drown. There's no recognition that the people that are boat people in the Mediterranean are there because of the war on terror.
Chase Palmieri here.
Peter, I have a question for you. I'm wondering how much of this is a generational thing. If enough time passes, that the problem of white nationalism will fade into the history books, or are there young people today who are grasping at these ideologies?
Oh, you've seen the alt-right. I mean, those people were all pretty much young. There's a pool of disaffected white youth that's always been drawn on for decades by these types of organizations, and I see no evidence that that's going away. I think it's getting stronger. And if you look at, like, say, White Rabbit Radio, there's a tremendous amount of online materials, including like the six-hour movie of Adolf Hitler, which is like the true story of Adolf Hitler, painting him as a pretty nice guy. There's a huge, easily accessible body of validation that you're okay as a white person, and it is targeting the youth. In fact, there's a lot of similarities between jihadist-type propaganda in music, Islamist rap, and music videos with what is coming out of the white supremacist movement. I mean, you had bands back in the day, back in the 90s, like Skinhead. White power rock was a huge draw for the youth, and that's actually not maybe as strong right now as the little vortices and pathways of racist kind of attacks on multiculturalism that aren't quite as pointed as, you know, Skinhead might have been, but which are targeting this notion that there's no reason that our race should be diminished, giving people affirmative action, which is taking away from us as if it was a zero-sum game.
Well, you see this with Richard Spencer. You see this with a lot of the neo-Nazi types claiming they're not Nazis, claiming that they're even not racist.
No, they're for freedom of speech.
Right. So it's a very strange and Orwellian twist. What do you think then is to be done about this issue here in the United States?
I'll start with the issue of jihadist insurgency and terrorism. That very clearly can be ameliorated and allowed to devolve and probably go away over a period of time if we stop attacking people's countries and taking their stuff. If we turn neoliberal globalization based on austerity and harming people into something that was more positive, like maybe a socialist type approach, which, you know, actually on paper looks pretty good. And here we need to have a society in which the president of the United States is not allowed to broadcast in the media the kind of racist tripe that this man has been promoting every day for 3 years now. That is CNN and the New York Times and the people that amplify his vile tweets are responsible for creating this culture in which you're going to find people that are willing to pick up bombs and guns to kill what they call MUDs.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Peter Byrne, and we'll also bring his son into the conversation, Miles Byrne, as he accompanied his father to a recent conference on terrorism and counterterrorism. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's show, we've been speaking with Peter Byrne. He is a Northern California-based award-winning investigative journalist. A few of his recent exposés include Busted, Breast Cancer, Money in the Media, as well as Going Postal, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends. Cheap. On this program, we've been focusing on Peter Byrne's more recent work published at NewScientist.com. And New Scientist magazine. One is Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists. And Peter Byrne, of course, says, well, it takes more than religious fanaticism or hatred to make someone take innocent lives. But recognize the true roots of ISIS-inspired terror, and they can be addressed. We're also speaking with him about his article on the origins of white nationalism. Peter Byrne, before the break, you were going back and forth, in fact, between war on terrorism abroad as well as what we're seeing in terms of extremism at home. And we did start making mention of what role the media play in the portrayal of these groups. So I figured, given the Project Censored Show, we often talk about media and media analysis. And, of course, you've done your own fair share of media criticism as a journalist. What are your thoughts on the issue of media and how these topics are being both presented and how you think maybe the media is not doing these topics justice?
Well, the so-called war on terror, the long war, is obviously a profit center for the major mainstream media. Not only does terrorism ISIS style with beheadings or Timothy McVeigh style with blowing up federal buildings increase ratings greatly when they occur, so people can sell. So they generate mass feelings of fear and anxiety, which is why terrorism works. And so even though the risk of actually being killed by a so-called terrorist is almost vanishingly small, we see our group threatened. So it works. And the media knows that. what is largely missing from the media reports on the so-called war on terrorism, which is a global war over the last 18 years, has been any voice of dissent from the scientific community, which is what I report upon in both of my New Scientist articles and in an upcoming book. The scientists originally, and I've interviewed hundreds of them, many of them were mobilized by the events of 9/11 to start using their science, whether it was neurobiology or psychology or physics or, you know, easily 20 or so disciplines, even including philosophy, to take a look at terrorism and what it is and what it is not and what works or doesn't work to ameliorate it. And what I found is that not only are scientists that are embedded within the military-industrial complex structure and in academia increasingly coming to the conclusion that the war on terror is the cause of terrorism, but people inside the military, advisors to Joint Chiefs of Staff, captains and colonels in the intelligence community, former Navy SEALs that are engaged in counterterrorism activities in Iraq and Afghanistan, have been telling me over and over and over again that every time we go and kill people in villages or with drones or ruin someone's economy, which is what these wars have been doing, or steal their resources, which is what these wars have been doing because they are wars, we create new generations of terrorists to replace the people that we kill because we kill their fathers and their own.
Interesting, Peter Byrne, that Noam Chomsky, in the many books he's written on the issue of terrorism, especially since 9/11, he's basically said, in his estimation, the best way to decrease terrorism or to help eradicate the problem of terrorism is to simply stop participating in it.
Absolutely, and I would concur, and I think that the interesting thing about my research is that now a huge proportion of people that study terrorism from a scientific basis or from the point of view of political science would also concur with him. Now, they may not want to say the words Noam Chomsky.
Yeah, right.
But they're saying the same things. And I found that even inside the Pentagon, I heard high-ranking people that study this in great detail saying the same things because they're fed up with the bloodbath and with the loss of what they call treasure. So when you look at the grievances of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, they always go back to the fact that we attacked their countries and destroyed their countries. You hear time and time again now at the highest levels of American government, well, we can't allow Iraq to break up into three separate nations. It's got to be one nation. Well, it was one nation when we attacked it. Regarding the Taliban, they say we can't leave Afghanistan because then the Taliban will win. Well, they're winning. It's been 17 years. So it's not rational that we keep doing this. Now, in an attempt to kind of unravel what's rational and what's not rational, I recently got a grant to organize a conference at UC Davis with Jim Crutchfield, who's a very renowned statistical physicist and complexity theorist. He's kind of legendary. And we gathered a bunch of scientists together for one day and had everybody make small presentations, and then we had a lot of talking back and forth on how can we define this problem of the relationship of counterterrorism to terrorism, where counterterrorism causes terrorism and terrorism causes feedback loop to cause counterterrorism. It's this kind of self-replicating loop. How do we interfere with that? And the point is that a lot of people that have the analysis that counterterrorism causes terrorism have no traction inside the White House or at the upper levels of the Pentagon or in Congress, which is run by the military-industrial Lockheed Martin, et cetera, complex. So the result of this conference, and these people, some of them have worked for years with the Pentagon, is that we can no longer do that sort of top-down organizing. We have to start doing a bottom-up type of organizing and getting out the word to normal people through whatever means that we can that counterterrorism causes terrorism. And then if we want to understand and stop terrorism, we have to first look in the mirror. And then we have to do things that may be seemingly distasteful, but in the long run would solve all sorts of problems, which is rethink and stop the kind of neoliberal austerity program, country-destroying globalism, so-called globalism that we've been exporting ever since Ronald Reagan. Rethink going in and stealing people's resources and using military force to annihilate entire cultures in a war which, you know, really is in many ways, like it or not, a war against the Muslim world, because all the countries that we attack happen to be pretty much Muslim, and that's how they view it. So we need to actually be honest and start taking a look at this and deciding, you know, what's in our real interest if we want to continue to have the occasional terroristic attack in New York and the daily terroristic attacks in countries that we've occupied, then we're going to have to stop the type of imperialist economics and militarization that we're doing that is actually also ruining the American economy.
Peter, this is Chase Palmieri. You just mentioned how the U.S. government keeps moving the goalposts in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm wondering, since you've been in Mosul and you've been abroad there, what is the best argument you've heard in favor for why the U.S. should still be in both of those countries?
I've not heard a good argument for that. There is no good argument for that. I mean, when I talk to ordinary people in Kurdistan and Erbil and Mosul, they were saying, you know, we were better off under Saddam Hussein. We hated him, but we were better off. Why don't you guys just leave? You know, there's the question that's always held out. Well, maybe the World Bank and the IMF can invest in the buildings that we just blew up and you can have new ones. Well, that doesn't go very far. Just ask people in Bosnia or Panama City. I mean, who wants the foreigners to own everything? And that's essentially what has happened in Iraq, foreign capital, especially the oil companies, have made a lot of headway. They haven't been able to grasp everything that they wanted. They ran into difficulties because the Russians also came in and stepped into some gaps, and so did the Chinese. And they've been making some pretty significant fossil fuel types of deals with disaffected Kurds and other factions. So actually, I think that, you know, the pottery burn thesis that Colin Powell so famously made before they invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and destroyed these vibrant, beautiful cultures, which if you broke it, we got to fix it. Well, actually, that's an insane formulation. If it's broken and you broke it, you can't fix it. The best thing you could do is to dump about $90 trillion on the table and walk away and say, I'm sorry, I'll never come back. I'm going to go home and think about what I did and apologize and try to educate my populace not to do such terrible things in the future, which there may be a lot of people in America that would like to do that. So the question is, how do we reach them? They need information. And that information, from my kind of crusade, if you will, in regard to this, is to use information that comes out from the inside of the system by hard-nosed scientists and military specialists, including some Navy SEALs that were embedded in the high parts of the counterintelligence circles, is to just walk away from it. Just stop. Nobody has ever really thought that ISIS, for example, or the Taliban were an existential threat to the United States. Those people can't destroy the United States. But we can destroy the United States by trying to continually destroy them.
Indeed, Peter Byrne. That's what Chalmers Johnson said in the Blowback trilogy. That's, again, what Noam Chomsky's been saying for years. Interesting allies, however, that you're talking about many people that are expert within the system that are part of the military-industrial complex or the national security complex, and you're saying intellectually that their arguments appear to mirror those on the left.
At the UC Davis conference, we had two retired Navy SEALs, one of whom was in charge of science at the National Counterterrorism Center until he recently retired, and another does consulting in the private sector on these issues. These guys spent a number of years after the invasions leading SEAL teams in to annihilate people in villages. They have blood on their hands. And they told me that it didn't work, that every time we killed somebody, we created 10 people that hated us. So now they're actually, both of them have some scientific backgrounds, very keen on using complex adaptive system theory to model this so that we can show, not just mathematically, but logically, and in language that people can understand, that every time that we do what it is that we've been doing for the last 17 years, which is a definition of insanity, of course, we're making the problem even worse. And we have to radically rethink what we're doing.
So if you're saying that counterterrorism abroad leads to more terrorists, does that mean that the U.S. shouldn't try to do any counterterrorism to the white supremacists within our own country because it would lead to more white supremacy?
No, I think that the solution path there is a bit different. As I mentioned earlier in the program, the violent extremism of the far right, you know, if you look at it like in a bell curve there on the outliers, it's going to be there as long as there's a medium of racism in the culture, which there is in America and always has been. As long as there is kind of this unconscious and conscious racism embedded in our culture, which is now getting, you know, more and more attention because it's being the fascists in the White House likes it, you're going to have those kind of people on the outliers. So it doesn't do much good to attack them because that just makes them stronger. And that's another lesson of counterterrorism in Iraq, Afghanistan, and in America. When you attack them, it makes them more resilient, which is because it's easier for them to disperse and reorganize and survive to fight another day, whereas a big lumbering, you know, Goliath can't do that. So if you want to reduce far-right terrorism in America, you have to not only reduce the cultural racism that is the foundation of our culture, but the same thing about neoliberal globalization applies. We need to completely reverse our imperialistic global projects and start reinventing our system of government and economics. Imperialist capitalism doesn't work. It's led us to this. It has clearly failed. We are a failed state here in the United States. So let's look for something different. Now, you know, people say, well, there isn't anything different. Look at communism and socialism. They failed everywhere they've been tried. And, you know, the answer to that is, yeah, they failed because capitalism came back, you know. I mean, anarchistic type programs have gone some distance too, but capitalism came back. So let's acknowledge those failures and not get caught up in a lot of metaphor baiting around that, but think logically about what it would mean to take profit out of the command of the American economy and put it on a basis where everybody can have a job, everybody can have a place to live, everybody can have an education, everybody can have access to health care. What would that look like? And of course we could do it. Hunter-gatherers were doing this 10,000 years ago. We've slid down since then, unfortunately.
We're speaking with independent journalist Peter Byrne. You can learn more about Peter Byrne's work at peterbyrne.info. That's B-Y-R-N-E. We've been talking about two of the articles that Peter published at thenewscientist.com online. You can see them. Anatomy of Terror, What Makes Normal People Become Extremists, is one from August of 2017. You can also see one from June this year. It is called On the Origins of White Nationalism. So it's also the case, Peter Byrne, that the conference that you were doing at UC Davis, you brought your son, Miles Byrne, who's 15 years old. Miles Byrne, you're here in the studio with us today, and I'm very curious to learn, what did you think of the interactions that were going there? What did you learn when you were at the conference?
The conference consisted of people from all sorts of academic disciplines, from sociology, from history, from the math department, from physics, and they pretty much were unanimously in agreement that the solution to terrorism, insofar as, you know, the various disciplines could tell, was to not be present where it was happening, was to not exacerbate, you know, the wound that they had already caused. And the Navy SEAL guys, who were people that were, you know, embedded in the counterterrorism industry, which is absolutely massive, had spent long enough floundering out there and had returned back saying that they realized that they were not getting anywhere with what they were doing. They had no clear objective. They did not have strategy. They were simply pouring military might into a place where military might had done nothing to reduce the damage that the people who had been radicalized were causing. And whenever you have someone who's growing up in a society that has been torn apart by an extraneous or an exterior influence, it's like, you know, the young people there, they don't know how to respond to this, right? I mean, the political, moral, and emotional infrastructure has been just totally altered. You know, it's never been able to settle down and reach a solid point. There's no comforting society that they can grow up around.
Well, Miles, as being a young person yourself, do you talk with people in your peer groups, you know, about these things, about these experiences? Do you talk about these kind of topics and subjects, and equally talk about them in the way that you just expressed, right? You were talking about what would it be like for young people to be growing up in these war-torn places. I mean, is this something that you talk to people here in the U.S. about?
Occasionally, not as much as I would like to. I think that there's a great deal of misinformation regarding terrorism. The media, which is a huge player, as you guys have mentioned again and again, and, you know, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers.
They're good at that.
Yeah, that's their job.
Frame it. Thank you very much for coming on the program today, Miles.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. The program was established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm also the executive producer of the program. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers include Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. All the programs are archived online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Richard Grossman Dismantling Corporations. Ralph Nader called Richard Grossman the preeminent historian of corporations. In his writings and teaching, Grossman warned us that unchecked corporate power would lead to the destruction of democracy. He said that the American Revolution was fought less against the king, but against the crown corporations, the Hudson's Bay and East India corporations. And he believed that it is time to remember that fight and assert sovereignty of the people over corporations and the corporate state. In the speech you are about to hear, he calls for dismantling the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth. End quote. Richard Grossman's research showed him that in the original intent of American revolutionaries, corporations did not have rights. They only had privileges, and only those that we the people bestow on them. They were to be limited by a revocable charter that specified what exactly they were allowed to do. Its board and shareholders were to be fully liable for any harm the corporation did. And they initially had none of the free speech rights that go along with personhood. If Richard Grossman were still alive today in 2017, he would be shocked to see that corporations and bankers, from Exxon to Goldman Sachs, from General Dynamics to Lockheed Martin, from Wells Fargo to pipeline builder Energy Transfer, all no longer are limited to purchasing influence by buying congresspeople one by one, but now they own and run large parts of the government directly. Here's a program I produced in 1995. I met Richard in the summer of 1995 in San Francisco. He had been invited to a retreat of the International Forum on Globalization that had formed just a year earlier. The task was to brainstorm on how best to alert the public on the consolidation of the global corporate structure enabled by the new trade agreements under the WTO. It was my job to record every speaker, and Richard's presentation made the deepest impression. For the 16 years that followed, I paid attention to his work and recorded and interviewed him on his rare visits to the West Coast. The atmosphere at the IFG retreat was friendly and organized. There was no audience. Everybody was a participant. Around the long table were some who had come from halfway around the world. They included the new members of the IFG, who later became well known: Vandana Shiva from India, Maud Balo from Canada, Martin Kaur from Thailand, to name just a few. Many met for the first time, and there was great curiosity every time a new voice was heard. Later, when I got to know Richard Grossman better, I was no longer surprised that he was provocative. Provocative not to be antagonistic, but to define a problem and fearlessly walk towards a conclusion without compromise. And whenever someone said to him, "But that's impossible," he would say, "Not if we actually take power, as others before us have done from time to time." Richard said, "You want democracy, community, an intact earth? We can't get there by obeying a law crafted by corporate masters and nature destroyers." So isn't disobedience the challenge of our age? Principled, inventive, escalating disobedience to liberate our souls, to transfigure our work as humans on this earth. End quote by Richard Grossman. But that first time that I heard him speak, his opening was a surprise. Richard Grossman.
I believe that the people around the world who see the enormous amounts of harms that are being inflicted by corporations and by governments are at a point to now forthrightly and directly announce a demand to dismantle the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth. to take back what they've taken from us and take back what they've taken from the natural world in order to build the kind of communities and sustain the natural world as we think is appropriate, based on human dignity and the functioning of natural systems. I think this is necessary tactically to help us to think and to help us to plan out actually what we're going to do. And it's necessary psychologically to help us to actually believe that we can do this. It's not that the 1,000 largest corporations necessarily are the sources of all our oppression. Yes, they oppress us. Yes, they are vehicles of enormous harms. And it's not that globalization, global markets, global production is the source of all our harms. I think that those are the names of harms. When I have an inflammation of the ear and it hurts, and I go to the doctor, and the doctor tells me you have otitis. Well, I already knew that. You know, that's the name. And I'm not fighting the name. I need to figure out the source and figure out how to stop it at the source. So I'm suggesting that we target explicitly and say we want to dismantle the 1,000 largest corporations off the face of the earth because of the nature of the modern large corporation, because it is the dominant institutional form all over the world. Now, we have some precedents. So here's a little history. In the 1700s, global corporations ruled the earth, a good part of the earth. The East India Company, the Africa Company, the Hudson's Bay Company, they were corporations. They were chartered corporations, chartered by kings who ruled by divine right. The phrase, the ship of state, comes, you know, very much from the fact that the ships of chartered corporations carried all the rights and privileges of statehood. You know, they went out to pillage and murder and enslave and destroy biodiversity and destroy culture and all of that. And they came home with huge amounts of money and resources. They were the ships of state. Global corporations governed. They raised taxes. They levied people into the army and navy. They told people what work to do and what work they couldn't do. They took control of the products of labor. They told you who you could trade with and who you couldn't trade with. They told you what you could grow and what you couldn't grow. They performed all the functions of government. They ruled. And they ruled with the consent of the governed. In India, or the subcontinent of India, essentially 100,000 English people, 50,000 soldiers and 50,000 bureaucrats, governed several hundred million people. The many consented to the rule of the few. Quite an achievement, I guess. In the colonies, in this country, many of the colonies, Massachusetts Bay Colony, the Virginia Colony, the Carolina colonies, were corporations. They were crown corporations. They governed. They ruled. They performed all the function of government. They got their authority from the king, you know, from God. The culture of the monarchy inhibited people from thinking about the sources of their oppression. It inhibited people from thinking and acting about the rights as human beings. One of the things that Tom Paine, an American pamphleteer, did in his pamphlet Common Sense, which sold millions of copies in a very short period of time, was to remove the facade of the monarchy culture, basically tracing back the history of King George of England to Norman the Conqueror, to these guys coming over from France, you know, pillaging and raping in England, taking control, creating this whole mythology of the kingdom. And to help people see that their task as people who claimed that they were free, or were moving towards claiming that they were free, their task was actually not to negotiate with the king, not to negotiate with the ministers of the king, but in fact to focus on where the power was. And in the course of the revolution, what they did by, you know, removing the king, by going after the power at its source, removing the king, the revolution in effect became the opportunity to transform, to dismantle the crown corporations that were governing in the colonies, and to take with the assets and to take what they had, and to create constitutionalized governments with elections, with mechanisms that a free people could use to control them. Elections, lawmaking, terms of office, processes where people had standing. Now, the revolution was flawed. Not all people had standing. There was a tremendous gap between the ideals and the language of the revolution, the ideals and the language of the Declaration of Independence, and the reality. And after the revolution, there was a struggle between those who wanted to make this a case of popular rule, to have the nature of governance in this country be popular rule, versus those who were seeking minority rule. And the people struggling for popular rule did the best they could. You know, they didn't win. They lost. In the process, though, they did create some tools to make it easier for future generations to resist concentrations of power and to undo those concentrations of power. One would be the very ideal, you know, the theory and ideal of the revolution, of the Declaration of Independence, and of the Constitution, the nature of the Bill of Rights. You know, the Bill of Rights, you know, preserving rights that the people had prior to their coming together to form a constitution. The Constitution begins, "We, the people of the United States, create this Constitution. We were people. We had rights as human beings. We come together, negotiate with one another in order to set up the mechanisms of self-governance." That's a legacy that some other countries share that went through similar processes at different times, and it can be a very empowering legacy. And then there are a lot of tools in there as well. One of the things that after the revolution was there was a clear sense that they were not going to turn over the ability to govern themselves to the institution of the corporation. I mean, people remembered, they had personal first-hand experience with the Hudson's Bay Company and the Crown corporations. The idea of the revolution was not to turn over their rights and their property and all of that to these other institutions. And so there was a very clear sense in law and in the popular culture that, in fact, corporations, the charter of incorporation, the license to incorporate, was a privilege. It was a public trust, and it was conditional. And the people, through the legislatures, defined the corporations through the charter and through the state corporation laws. It wasn't the case that people were saying, we're going to define the level of harm we allow them to do to us. It says, we will define the very nature of these institutions. We will say how much capital they can concentrate in one place. We will make them all liable, the directors and the shareholders and the officers will make them liable for the harms that they cause. We will give them a time limit. You can have this charter for 5 years, and then you have to come back to us, and we'll decide whether or not we should renew it. You'll have to come to us and say what projects you want to do with the privilege of incorporation, and we'll either say yes and we'll no, condition after condition after condition. And the two fundamental conditions were, I mean, they weren't even conditions, they were the fundamental realities, were that the people, the sovereign people, people who had been through this struggle of the revolution, were in fact sovereign over the subordinate institution that was the fiction called the corporation. What the people can create, the people can uncreate. So they reserved the right in the charters themselves and in the state corporation law to amend the charter and to revoke the charter for cause, for abuse and all that, but also at whim, because the people were sovereign. When the people are sovereign, you don't need a reason if you choose to take it back. So the literature, the history, the legacy is very, very rich. The two phrases through the 19th century, the legal phrases that were the processes to raise the issue in the public forums and in the constitutionalized process of a free people, in legislatures, in the courts, and in the press, to talk about what corporations were doing that were causing harm, were two Latin phrases. Mm-hmm. One is quo warranto, by what authority? You know, it wasn't too many parts per million. You know, it wasn't you're not allowing union people to organize. It was by what authority have you taken this action? That was the basis of convening the legal process to determine. And the second was ultra vires. What you have done is beyond your authority. So the very phrases and the process reflect the relationship that the people in those days saw existing between the sovereign people, as defined, limited and flawed, but as defined, and this legal fiction that was the corporation. Quickly enough, by the end of the century, a counter-revolution had taken place. After the Civil War, banks, railroad corporations, grain corporations, other corporations, became powerful enough to, in fact, undo in law this theory, and to, in fact, to place the government as a barrier between the institution of the corporation and the sovereign people. You know, by creating the beginning of the regulatory and administrative state, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the Sherman Antitrust Law, where the bedrock principles were not the people's sovereignty, but the laws of the market, which is a very sinister thing, because when, in fact, we, the people, consent to the elevation of the laws of the market over the laws of a sovereign people who come together to negotiate our rights and our mechanisms of dealing with one another, then you automatically elevate the institution of the market to being beyond the authority of the people, and that's the corporation. And so what you had was a transformation in property rights and laws. What you had was the people consenting to the giving of corporations more rights than people had. Corporations were declared persons by the Supreme Court of the United States. What that meant was they now had equal protection of the law. They had the full faith and protection of the United States government. The Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, which was to preserve the human rights of free speech and assembly and practice of religion, in order to resist concentrations of power, in order to help future generations of people to govern themselves, then became a tool of the corporation. Once the corporations become persons, then they have free speech. Once they have free speech, you cannot pass laws. You know, a municipality or a state or the Congress can't pass a law to say this: no corporation may participate and undermine the fundamental sacred mechanisms of a free people: elections, lawmaking, judicial proceedings, and the press, information. The positive, powerful legacy of the American Revolution, despite its flaws, and the tools that were supposed to be entrusted to the next generation have gone by the wayside. And we have consented over this last 100 years to putting our time and energy as activist citizens into arenas which are fundamentally, for the most part, not about power. They're not about self-governance. When we get involved in regulatory administrative struggles on the nature of pollution, and on whether we should have 60-day notice for a plant closing, those are not about fundamental self-governance and authority over who makes the rules as to where money is invested, under what terms it's invested, who controls our labor, who controls the products of our labor, and what rights we have as free people, as sovereign people, to organize our communities and our regions and our societies as we choose. The other thing that happened also in the 1890s, at the time of this consolidation of corporate power, was the parallel pushing of the United States into the world arena, onto the backs of the world. I mean, that's when we took the Philippines, Cuba, and driven by the corporation, looking for resources and world markets. So there was a real connection there. Now, the 1890s was also the last citizen effort to challenge the corporate state, the populist movement. Urban workers, intellectuals, and farmers coming together to form the populist movement, 1885 to the end of the century, 1896. People were very clear that they were suffering harms at the hands of corporations, but that corporations had become the rulers. And so the slogans of all the farmers' parties and the people's parties was, we have to end the corporate state. They weren't talking about regulating the corporations to decrease the amount of harms that they were doing. They weren't talking about legalizing poisoning. They were talking about ending the corporate state and resurrecting the ideals of self-governance. Except for some blips in this century, after World War I and after World War II, we've been very compliant. We've been submissive. We've been playing in their ballpark, under their rules, within what has become the equivalent of the monarchy culture, which I think is a corporate colonial culture. They've gotten our language. They've taken our minds. I think they've taken our ability, to a large extent, to strategize. They've affected how we think and how we talk to one another. When, in fact, I'm speaking on environmental issues, environmental people coming to be environmentalists in the 50s and 60s started to raise the questions of poisons in the air and poisons in the water. So people respond and say, oh, there are poisons in the air and the poisons in the water. We want this taken care of. So what did we, the environmental movement, do? Speaking broadly. Well, we sought and passed laws that legalized poisoning. You know, we sought and passed the National Environmental Policy Act, which is considered the cornerstone of environmental regulation of this era. Well, it doesn't mention the word corporation. It does not apply to corporations. It has nothing to do with dealing with addressing the relationship between the sovereign people and the institution of the corporation, which has been the primary decider of where capital goes, what's made, and how it's made. The National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act in the 1930s, it had many positive virtues. And regulation has saved a lot of people. But what happened with labor was that they saw it and agreed, and there was opposition at the time, but they saw it and agreed to a law where the government defined the rights of people, workers, to associate together, defined their rights and defined what they could even talk about. The fundamental issues, the most important ones, investment, the nature of production, the organization of work, defined it off the agenda. And so workers' movements in the place where the issues were the most fundamental, where in fact people could feel internally every day what was happening, the fundamental issues that determined how people live, that determined what people made, that determined the nature of production, was off the agenda. Of course there was a conflict between jobs and the environment, because we had given up our authority over the fundamental question of money and production and the nature of work. Chartering is a tool, like many tools, and it's about defining the corporation and defining our relations with it. When we challenge the existence, the authority of the corporations, we set up the kind of struggle out of which these issues become clear. One of the things that we could do is seek to amend the existing charters of corporations and revoke the charters of existing corporations. First of all, it hasn't been done. It hasn't been attempted of a big corporation for a century. I mean, it's a whole area with a very rich history and a lot of opportunities. We actually engaged some lawyers to look into the press and say, what would it mean? And we got back all kinds of papers and memos explaining the precedents and what it would mean. What became clear is that what a revocation of a charter means is a political issue. It fundamentally depends on how powerful the people's movements who are driving this are. You know, if we're talking about taking their assets, taking our assets back in order to use what's usable to reconfigure our communities and getting corporations out of the mechanisms of a democratic people, we go on the offensive. We create a whole new realm in which we have tools and legacies and in which, in this country, it's in the popular culture. These ideals, the notion of sovereignty, it's in the popular culture, even if it's been neglected and not utilized. Why not take on frontally the doctrine of personhood? Why not take on the doctrine of managerial prerogative, that corporations have all these rights over investment, over production, over the nature of work, and over the organization of work? You know, why not begin to seek a bill of rights for work? Not a bill of rights, the bill of rights. Workers don't have free speech. They don't have rights of assembly. They have no redress of grievances. You know, corporations are not constitutionalized. They are governed, but they are authoritarian, perpetual governments. And next, almost lastly, what are we, a free people, what are we doing allowing fictions to be sullying the mechanisms of a free people? Why are corporations in elections in any way? So to me, the issue is not let's get money out of politics. Let's get corporations out of elections. Same thing with legislation. What are corporations doing lobbying? Why do we permit that? Lawmaking is for a free people. These are fictions. Why are they there? They should be out. Mariah mentioned the work of Alex Carey, and many other people have done work on the NAM and the Chamber of Commerce and the Chemical Manufacturers Association. All these, what we call, we honor them by calling them trade associations. They're corporations of the corporations. And they are the ones who are driving legislation. They are the ones that are driving elections. They are driving the rewriting of the laws and the interpreting of the laws, and they are driving our press and our information. The basic mechanisms of a free people, we have given up to these legal fictions. In the United States, we have a special obligation given the role of the United States on the backs of the rest of the world. That if we in the United States begin to focus on dismantling the 300 or so of the largest corporations in the world that are chartered in the United States, you know, maybe we can give some space and some room to the struggles in other countries. You know, maybe we can legitimate, in this bastion of corporate and capital control, we can legitimate the idea that a free people doesn't have to operate, internalize the corporate culture. That we, in fact, can believe that what exists now was not inevitable, is not irreversible, is the most efficient, leads to the most freedom, and all that junk. That we don't have to concede that the laws of the market supersede the laws that human beings, free human beings, sentient human beings, coming together to negotiate with each other can make. We have to remember that we, that free people, do not negotiate with governments. We don't negotiate with corporations. We negotiate with one another. And I think, under all, we need to shift from these cultures of resistance to harms one at a time, or to save one forest at a time, or to fight one corporation at a time, to cultures of struggle, which are about self-governance. That the vision is self-governance, and the path will then come out of the struggles that people are involved with all the time. Frederick Douglass said, I'll give it a mangled paraphrase, power concedes nothing without a struggle. Not to believe that is to believe that we can harvest crops without plowing the ground. Now, what makes me optimistic is I don't think for 100 years that we have thought about, in a serious, long-term way, engaging in a struggle for self-government against the concentrated powers that are arrayed against us. And that is something we begin to do, and the corporations are the path into that.
That was Richard Grossman on Dismantling Corporations, a talk that could have been given yesterday. Instead, it was recorded in 1995 at a retreat of the International Forum on Globalization. Richard Grossman was an early voice in the movement to not just revoke personhood and repeal the Charter of Corporations, but to challenge the corporate state. Richard died of melanoma on November 22, 2011. In the last 15 years, he had been an important member of POCLAD, the Project on Corporations, Law and Democracy, and CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. His and CELDEF's lasting legacy are the democracy schools that continue to be taught across the country. They examine the history of the rise of corporate power and devise strategies for disrupting that power. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of Richard Grossman on Dismantling Corporations by calling 1-703-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition of Radio Curious, our associate producer, Christina Onestad, is a guest host in conversation about puberty rights for young women within the Winnemem Wintu tribe of Northern California. Her visit with Kayleen Sisk Franco, the spiritual leader and chief of the Winnemem Wintu tribe, was recorded near Mount Shasta, California, in August of 2010.
The Winnemem Wintu are a small tribe in Northern California. During World War II, they were relocated and their homeland was flooded to make the Shasta Dam. Nearly 80 years later, the tribe has reinvigorated one of its ceremonies there, called the Puberty Ceremony, which honors a girl's transition into womanhood. For 3 days and nights, men sing and dance on one side of a river, while the women pass on traditions on the other side. But holding a ceremony on stolen land can be a challenge. The U.S. government has not granted the Wintus requests to access their ancestral land in privacy. The puberty ceremony is held with recreational boaters driving by and camping as the tribe works to hold its rite of passage. Under the guidance of their chief and spiritual leader, Kalene Sisk Franco, the Winnemem Wintu have sued the federal government to protect their rights to privacy and their ancestral land. Kalene Sisk Franco says preserving the puberty ceremony is preserving their way of life.
We say that because it's what most Americans would understand about puberty, having knowledge about puberty. But for us, the Winnemem, we call it the Bothless Chonus, which means that we are bringing our girls into a system or a culture that really demands that they be connected. And this is that ceremony that weaves not only them into the tribe, but the tribe together again. And when they all come together, they all dance. They're all waiting for the young girls to come back as young women. And when they do, there is a place for them. And there is a belonging that happens. And there's an ownership that all of the women share. And when the puberty belts are put on them, that is the good blessings of all of the women in the tribe. That wishing them well, that's committing to helping them. Whatever they might need throughout their life, their commitment is to be there. And we all can't take care of everything for every person, but there's going to be somebody here who will be able to talk to them about childbirth. There'll be somebody here to talk to them about problems with their boyfriends or husbands or problems with their children or, you know, juggling things around or making ends meet. Everybody has their expertise. So when they put that puberty belt in, that's their commitment as the other women to accept the young ladies. And that's what weaves our people together, the foundation. And I think that's why we're still here. You know, we survived on the foundation of our elders. Like my great aunt was the last generations before we started doing this that went through the full puberty ceremony before this lake was here. All up and down there were different puberty rites. We had to bring this back in full because, you know, the last ones were done in the late 20s, and those people who held that for us are all passing on. And so we had to bring it back before we didn't have it anymore.
What's the cultural importance of having this ceremony, of continuing this ceremony for the Winnemem Wintu?
Well, this is the pretty much the bottom line of if there's going to be more Winnemem. It's not enough to just be Indian blood. If you don't have a culture, you don't have a way, you don't have a belief, you don't have your sacred sites, you don't have your language, then what do you have?
You as a chief, why are you continuing on with traditional ways, and what's the importance of that to you?
The traditional ways to me, like Grams has taught me, is that the world that is out here is pretty much an artificial world. The modern way of life is an artificial life because it doesn't require you to really know anything or do anything or be responsible to or for anything. If you forget, you could go to the library and look it up. But in the old days, when you had real knowledge, you would always remember which plants are poison, which plants are medicines, which plants are edible. And you couldn't afford not to know it. But if you have artificial learning, it's kind of like kids that learn their timetables, and then the next grade they forget them, and then they learn them again, and then they forget them. And then when you get to be an adult, it's like, oh, let's see, let me figure that out. But in the old days, when you had to have real learning and real life and real consequences that you could see, then you were more in harmony or more in tune with nature, and you can live. It's like she says, there's so many people who are have such an easy life that when nature changes, they're going to suffer because they never like to get wet. They never like to get cold. They never like to get hot. And so they take care of all of that. So they live in this little space, a mediocre space. And whenever it gets too hot, they're gonna suffer because they're not used to it. It's an artificial world. As long as the artificial continues, you know, the salmon used to run up this river. They don't run up this river no more. The mitigation for this dam was Coleman Fish Hatchery. But we're not real Indians, so we can't get fish from the Coleman Fish Hatchery.
And when you say real, you mean federally recognized?
Yes. Federal card carrying, it doesn't matter. It's like, as long as they can prove a drop of blood somewhere, you know, you take a group of people who have no money, you put them on a reservation, and you give them minimal amounts of food, you're guarding them with force to keep them there. And then now they're going to be able to reorganize and run their own governments and do this. But if you choose to be traditional, they're not going to help you with any money. If you choose to remodel the American government structure, you get a lot of money to do that. Set up the council, set up the voting stuff, set up, you know, your constitution. But if you want to go traditional, no money. Do it on your own. So what the most of the tribes choose, they're going to go with where the money is because they don't have any. And so now you have all of these little governments that replicate the United States, and nobody is trained to actually run a government like that. I mean, people don't go to school like President Obama to be the chairman of the tribe. Nobody goes to school and learns all the stuff about it to be on the council like your congressman. You know, what would happen if Sitting Bull's term was up in the midst of all of this wartime? It's like, oh no, I'm not the chief no more. Vote in another chief. Or any of them. You know, the famous chiefs were never voted in chiefs. Yet, you know, the tribes now readily accept that model of, because the United States is saying, well, if it's not like that, it's not a democracy, therefore it must be an anarchy. You know, it must be, you know, a kingdom or, you know, kind of thing. But for us, you know, we don't vote. You're born into it. You have a responsibility to it, which goes both ways. It's like, if you're responsible for it, you're responsible until it's handed off. It's not like, if you put it down, it's like killing your people. I mean, how many other people are willing to live a lifetime serving their people? It's like, I'm going to do my 4 years and I'm done. That's all the commitment I have. But for us, the direction that we go in or the teachings that we have follow that whole lifetime, which has come from another lifetime of teaching that brings us to the place where we are. You know, that lifetime was based on another lifetime that is steadily thinking of the river, thinking of the salmon, thinking of these sacred places. You know, so it doesn't change much, only that what we have to deal with on the outside, we have to deal with the Forest Service. We have to figure out, you know, how do we get the government to recognize that we have rights?
You're listening to a Radio Curious interview with Colleen Sisk Franco, chief and spiritual leader of the Winnemem-Wintu, the Middle Water people of Northern California. Colleen Sisk Franco spoke with Radio Curious associate producer Christina Onestad in August 2010 at a Winnemem-Wintu puberty ceremony honoring girls' transition into womanhood. I'm Barry Vogel, host and producer.
What goes on over the course of the ceremony?
Every day there's visitors to the girls They every morning they go up river and wash and clean and pray. And they have their protectors and their attendant that'll take care of them. And today we'll be taking them up to the women's camp because that's where the women gather. It'll be their first gathering at the women's camp. And then we'll take their basket caps to be blessed in the Cold Springs. But every day they're growing stronger spiritually. They're asked to leave their childhood ways, like they will recognize them. You know, even though we all try to, you know, we can all go back to a childhood way of acting, but at the same time we can see the difference. And right now when young girls, they don't see the difference. And as they come through these 4 days, they'll start recognizing that those differences that they'll be able to adjust and grow from. You know, it's not going to be an overnight thing, but they will be able to manage that better. I mean, we're recognizing as a community their strengths to do this.
How do you mark the difference between youth and womanhood?
I guess a different way of thinking, a different way of responsibility, taking on a little different approach to things. You know, not the mama's girls as much. You know, they'll start recognizing, and that's why we, you know, ask the moms to come out and also accept the changes that their daughters will be going through, and not to look at it as rebelling or. You know, to work with them. But these things, you know, I think would be good for all kids, all teenagers. Everybody should be special. Every woman that has those changes coming out should be special, not just kind of bounce through it and try to figure it out. I mean, we'd have a lot less teen pregnancies and we'd have a lot less, you know, teen women violence. Because they, like over there, we're saying, you have to learn to respect your body, respect yourself, just like this, the two sisters. The respect that the two sisters have among the men, because this is also the mountain that the young men climb. And it's a very difficult mountain to climb. But that's developing the relationship from men and women. The men have to adjust to what women are because they're solid. That's what they're learning. And not all of them can climb to the top the first time they go. But they have to learn how to adjust to the women. They're our protectors and our providers. They're not our directors.
How does the puberty ceremony also shape the way young men are brought into the culture?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The young men, see, they're the dancer, but they're also over there. The two protectors, the fire tender. But on this side, all of the men are here dancing for those girls. All of the men are showing the respect for these girls. So it's putting them, I mean, they are, one might say that they are succumbed to doing this, but it is their choice. I mean, it is the way that the tribe operates. The other part of it is that during one of the dances, it's called a crazy horn dance. And the crazy horn dance is where the men basically make fools of themselves to make the girls laugh. Their job is to try to make her laugh. And whatever it takes, that's what they're going to do. Which teaches them that pleasing the girl is very important in their life. That whatever it is, even to belittle themselves to get done what needs to be done for them, should not be below them. And the girls are not supposed to laugh. I mean, it kind of puts it into perspective of our places, you know, and how we get along in our relationships later. You know, because a lot of people have too much pride to apologize or whatever it is.
You're also the tribe's spiritual leader. What does that mean, and what does that entail?
That means we're the keeper of the medicines, that we keep our doctoring ways, our connection to the spirits. We talk to the Creator through the sacred places, that we get direction from them. All of the things that we choose to do, like when we did the war dance on the Shasta Dam, came down from a sacred place. It's not like we get together and we say, what's our next stance? What are we going to do? It's like these come in, and then we have to figure out how to do that. It's like everybody in the tribe goes, what? War dance. Last war dance done was in 1887 when they were putting the fish hatchery in. And then what are your war dance songs? When the war dance songs came in, they were songs that were asking, like, the old salmon to come back. They were asking that the ones that fly to send down their blessings. You know, it wasn't like, kill all the white people. or anything like that, or like, you know, real violent kind of songs. It didn't come in that way at all. And then the more that we went along, it's like the dreams that were coming in to several of our guys are dreamers. We sent them up on top of the mountain to fast. It's like, we need this because that's what they're calling for. They're calling for this, and we have to figure out the best way to get it done. And so we sent the guys up on the mountain to fast, and after that, they started dreaming. And they could see the old-time dancers and how they came in, and another one would see how they were dancing. And we could hear the song. You know, they'd say, oh, it had this kind of a beat. You know, so it's like that's the spiritual part of it is that all of our spiritual ways are still here. We have gotten lost. If we would come back and be here and be connected, it's all still here because that's how the spiritual is. It lives here. It's like this mountain here. This is called the Two Sisters. The Two Sisters are the ones who will watch over these girls on the other side. They will stop what they're doing when we put the foot drum in and they hear that call, the song. They'll stop what they're doing. They'll come down and they'll help the girls figure out in their life what needs to be done for them. They'll figure out how to settle them down. They'll watch them the whole time. But that's why it's important. Like one of the guys said, well, we could just move that rock for you. Puberty rock. It's like, well, can you move that mountain too? And can you move this river? Because it all ties together. It's all one thing.
Can you tell us what was the war dance? When and what was it for?
We did the war dance in 2004 to show, well, actually to tell the river and the sacred places that we are willing to do whatever it takes to stop them from raising the lake because they've already lost too much. We've already lost too much. But it was an agreement between us and the sacred places. If they are going to push that through and destroy it, it's direct genocide. You know, it's a cultural genocide what they're doing without giving us any rights to hold our own ceremonies, to practice our own ways of life.
In 2006, the Winnemem Wintu, your tribe, reinvigorated the puberty ceremony, which had not really been done in full for about 85 years. And because this ancestral homeland is now Federal Forest Service land, you had to go through the Forest Service to gain access. Can you tell us what was that experience like and what happened?
We have a very long-standing history with the Forest Service. We have sacred sites all along this area, all the way up to Mount Shasta. That is now claimed by Forest Service. So we have been butting heads with Forest Service forever. I mean, since they were created, that we have had a long-term relationship in trying to use our sites. And my Grams, the leader before me, fought with them all the way through the 50s and 60s because, you know, they started building campgrounds on our village sites, the village sites that should have been given to us once they flooded our homes under the lake. But it wasn't. Instead, they came in and put campsites on our villages. In 1978, when they had the American Indian Religious Freedoms Act pass, my grams was the first one to utilize that act to get a permit for our sacred site. I mean, we're not just a pop-up tribe overnight. You know, we're thinking we should just come in here and be able to use this place. They have records upon records of years upon years of us and this land. And so for them to, you know, conveniently forget those things, every time they change staff, we don't. But every time a new ranger comes on, it's like they must not give them any of those books, any of those. It's not important enough to school them about the tribe who lives here. Actually, this ceremony should have taken place last year. But again, the Forest Service has a bad memory and forgot that we already done it one time. And what had happened then and how to do the security, how to provide a safety for us as well as any boaters. Because we were saying, you know, like, why wouldn't you tell the boaters that during these 4 days, you know, go somewhere else on the lake? There's 375 miles of lake, you know, so let them vacation somewhere else. But last year it couldn't happen because they had a memory problem.
What has their response been to holding the ceremony here? What did you want from them?
We asked for the complete use of the campground, which we didn't get in 2006. We only got this area right here. And we asked for a closure of 200 yards of the river from the lake. And that was it. And they can't do that.
So what's the importance of having this area closed off for this ceremony?
Well, the importance is that, one, we should have an indigenous right to have and to hold our ceremonies in privacy. There are certain things that are happening within the ceremony itself that belong to the people. It's not on display. It's not a show. It's not a demonstration for people to come and look at. You know, it has spiritual connotations to it that those lines shouldn't be interrupted by people who are not supposed to be here. In addition, we worry about people coming in with alcohol. We don't want that in our ceremonies. It never was in our ceremonies before, and it has no place. You know, a lot of American Indians already have a lot of problems with alcohol, and we just don't need it around here. And people on this lake, you know, they're coming up for a vacation. They're coming up to have fun, and that's part of their fun. So having boats come through with alcohol in them, because our huts are on the other side of the river, is going right through a spiritual connection. And that's what they don't understand. It's like, well, the waterway is different. But if it was all land there, we wouldn't allow anybody walking through there with a six-pack, you know, of alcohol. And because it's a water, you let a boat go through with all the alcohol on it, we should have the right to say no. We should have the right to say that's not right. You know, we don't need that. But right now, I feel like, you know, if there's any chance at all for us, it would be with the United Nations Declaration of Indigenous Human Rights, where all of these things are covered in those articles. The right to pass on our traditions, the right to teach our kids our distinctive and cultural ways in privacy and utilize our territory and traditional places that were always ours before this came about. You know, when a government comes in and does not pay just and fair compensation, does not do any kind of consultation or get our consent or have any paperwork that shows where they had taken this land from us, and then turn around and say, well, it's public land and we have to let all the public in. That's not right. It's fine for them to have federally recognized tribes, but it's not fine for them to deny other tribes their rights to practice their religions and traditions. Where are the rights for the unrecognized tribes? They should have some rights, too. They're still tribes. They're still Indians.
Can you describe a eureka moment in your life?
A eureka. I think that when I first swam the falls, we have a tradition where you swim the falls like salmon up river. There's three different falls. And you hear about it, but until you do it, there's nothing like it. It's like, oh, that's what they're talking about. Salmon do this in this cold water.
And why do you swim the falls?
For the salmon. Yeah, for them to return. Yeah, that's what we're hoping.
Is there a book you'd recommend?
You know what? I'm not a reader. I think the only book I've read is like Pooh Bear. And I like Pooh Bear stories. I like the one where when he gets a balloon and he goes up into the tree where the honey is and he eats all the honey and he's still hanging onto the balloon and he can't get down. And he calls to Christopher to use his slingshot to hit the balloon so he could get down. And, of course, Christopher says, just let go. Well, I can't let go. But the result is the same. You know, it's kind of like people. It's kind of like this world with oil. I can't let go of the oil. But if you take it from me, then I'll figure out something else to do. You know, the lumber. I can't stop logging, but if you take it from me, then I'll figure out something else. But I can't let go of it, like the gold, you know. I can't let go of it.
Last question. What would you like to do with the rest of this life?
I would like, one, to see the salmon back in this river.
Radio Curious associate producer Christina Anastad spoke with Colleen Sisk Franco, the chief and spiritual leader of the Winnemem-Wintu tribe in Northern California, in August 2010. The book Colleen Sisk Franco recommends is Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne. For more information on the Winnemem-Wintu tribe, you can visit their website, www.winnemem-wintu.us. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah 95482, California